by the State Security Agency on the vetting process of senior officials in the Secretariat in Ireland. I'll speak to that before we introduce the delegation from the State Security Agency. And then importantly, we're going to have a briefing from the South African Police Service on efforts made to reduce incidents of crime against vulnerable groups, including women, children, the elderly, and the lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender community, including foreign nationals. That will happen at 10 o'clock. That delegation will be led by the National Commissioner General Sithole and I think a team of 8 other representatives. Then, members, just to indicate that next Wednesday, we will have the Civilian Secretariat on the DBA reports, as well as a briefing by the National and Provincial Community Police Boards on their own. Then, 3rd of June, we will have a follow-up with the Central Firearms Registry on the briefing by SAPS on the progress to that, as well as 4 groups, Hunters South Africa, the Hunters Association, as well as other role players. Then Wednesday, the 10th of June, we will have a follow-up briefing with SAPS and stakeholders on the Criminal Justice System Modernization Program. Honourable members will remember that's a follow-up in terms of the previous meeting that we held with SAPS, and we will also invite to that meeting Public Works and other role players. Wednesday, 17th June, is a briefing on the Border Management Agency, and we also invite Public Works. And then the last meeting of the term will be on Wednesday, 24th of June, SAPS and proclamations, as well as the consideration and adoption of outstanding reports and minutes. So, members, that will release the program for the rest of the term. Now, members will remember the first part of our program today. We had the hearings on the Secretariat as well as IPED, and the issue of vetting came sharply on the agenda. I just want to read from our report that was adopted by the National Assembly or by the committee and tabled on last Monday in terms of the vetting. Yeah. Regarding the Civil Secretariat and Civilian Secretariat, the committee asked the CSP whether personnel, especially the senior management structure SMS, are vetted and have valid security clearance certificates. The CSP responded that the CSP personnel are not vetted. This has implications on the functioning of the CSP. For example, the drafting of the white paper on safety security was contracted to an outside service provider due to security concerns in addition to capacity constraints. The committee raised serious concerns about this and flagged it as a key recommendation. Now, if we go to the recommendations that was made and adopted by the committee, it also deals with this issue. And it says the committee recommends that all staff should be vetted as a matter of urgency, including the SMS. The committee resolved that it will invite the DG of the State Security Agency to further discuss the privatization of security clearances for the CSP personnel. Now, members will also remember during our interaction with IPAC, there was an indication from the acting executive director, Mr. Khamanyani, that he's been cleared, but he said all the others is also currently waiting for the clearance certificates. And maybe just to again read from the report that was adopted by this committee. Vetting, the committee asked whether the SMS of the IPAD are vetted and have valid security clearance certificates. The IPAD states that the entire SMS has submitted their completed documents to the State Security Agency for processing. The acting executive director has a valid security clearance certificate since 1997. The IPAD committed themselves to ensure that this SMS has the required security clearance. So that was part of that decision that was made. Maybe also to indicate that one of the concerns that the committee discussed was the testimony by the acting secretary of the Civilian Secretariat that most of management doesn't got clearances for a number of years. And that was really flagged as a problem because both those departments are the security cluster. They work with classified matters ranging from top secret to confidential. And it's very important that we get an assurance from the State Security Agency that there is indeed proper methodology in place, but also the urgency. And if there's currently challenges or stumbling blocks, those must be on the table that we can make the necessary recommendations. So that is more or less the background for this first item. I'm going to ask then the members to introduce themselves.
morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Angie Mulati. I am a member of this committee. Thank you.
Morning. My name is Pindile Mora, member of this portfolio committee. Thank you.
Morning. My name is Leonardo Matakane, member of the committee.
The Machel Roman and the Madisha Rivohan, member of our committee.
Good morning. Excuse me. Good morning, member of the committee.
And Diane Kolobana, member. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will. I think the DG is not available, but welcome. You can introduce yourself and then continue the presentation.
Okay, Chairman. My name is Mr. Zoro. And the general manager responsible for external vetting within the state security agency. I'm standing in for the DG who's not there available.
Welcome to go ahead with your presentation and then we'll take questions. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Chairperson. As the chairperson indicated, we received a request to come brief the portfolio on the vetting status of top management within the police secretariat and the IP. And this is the report with regard to that request. The scope that I will cover during the presentation will briefly touch on the mandate of the state authority, the meeting we had with the civilian secretariat, the very status report of both independent police directorate and the civilian secretariat, then I will conclude. The mandate of the National State Security Agency, as indicated in the National Strategic Intelligence Act, as amended by the General Intelligence Law Amendment Act, Section 2A, one is to conduct and determine the security competence of a person, if such a person is employed by or is an applicant to an organ of state, or is rendering a service or is given a notice of intention to render a service to an organ of state, which service may give him or her access to classified information and intelligence in the possession of the organ of state, or give him or her access to areas designated national key point in terms of the National Key Point Act 1980, Act 102 of 1980. The Act further states that the agency shall be responsible for vetting of persons contemplated in subsection 1, and on request of the South African Police Service or the National Defence Force, persons employed by applicants to or persons rendering a service to the South African Police Service or the Department of Defense and Military Veterans. In line with the above legislative requirements, the Civilian Secretary for Police submitted to the State Security Agency a request on the 3rd of December 2014 requesting assistance with the vetting of their top management officials. I should also stress that the request did not have the names to be names of the officials vetted. The SSA then requested a meeting with the civil police to determine who among the officials should prioritize. The secretariat has not been available since December, and we only managed to get hold of them and interact with them on the 11th of May. During that meeting of the 11th of May, I, as a person representing the SSA, gave a detailed process to the acting secretary, Ms. Kore, regarding the completion, submission of relevant documentation, including the availability of officials to be vetted. A total of 11 officials were identified as requiring immediate security clearances. The identified officials are as follows: the acting secretary herself, Mr. Masivini, who is the corporate service, Ms. Bell, who is head of the legislative unit, Ms. Omar for policy and research, Mr. Zimu, partnership unit, Mr. Passon, and Mr. Mgao from the office of the secretary, Mr. Kompo, who has the monitoring and evaluation, Mr. Matang, who is also from the partnership unit, Mr. Robert, who is the chief financial office, in the chief of financial office unit, and Mr. Masangu was also in the office of the secretary. As I've indicated, ever since we started trying to engage the secretary from December, we only managed to meet them on the 11th of May. And subsequent that, we requested them to submit a Z204 forms, which according to the acting head, were submitted. Some of them were submitted to the office in October, November. But when we requested from them to submit to us so that we can start the process, since the 11th of May, we've only received two completed Z204 forms. We as the SSA have set up a special project to look at the vetting of the top officials within the Secretary of Police. But I just want to indicate again that the SSA will endeavor to complete the vetting of the above-mentioned officials within 4 weeks, even though we are under immense capacity constraint. If you look at the vetting status of personnel at IP, the number of officials with valid security clearances are 9, including the suspended head, Mr. McBride. Ms. Antoinette Mpako is the director of the executive support. Mr. Kuba, the provincial head of investigation, Bopo. Murema, director of investigations, Northern Cape. Miholo, director of investigation, the Western Cape. Musi, Director of Investigation, Free State. Harold Geller, Director of Investigation, Eastern Cape. Mr. Zarino, the National Spokesperson. And the Chief Financial Officer, Mr. Ngongo. 12 of the top management of IP, their vetting process is still in process. They are 12 as indicated, as Sisoko is the Chief Director of Investigation. Nesiano is the Chief Director of Corporate Services. Mutuale is Provincial Head of Investigation, Northern Cape. Chokolo is the Provincial Head of Investigation, Western Cape. Motalo is the Director of Investigation, Northwest. Mukwena is the Director of Investigation, Limpopo. Fatu is the Director of Legal Services. Mawoka is the Director of Legal Services. Fritz, Director of Policy and Provincial Coordination, Palazzi, Director of Human Resources, Memo Singur, Director of Information Technology, the current Acting Executive Director, Samayan. The 12, they have security clearance, is still in process. 12 of the top officials of IP do not have valid clearances. And when I say they do not have valid clearances, it's because they have not submitted any documentation requesting the SSA to get there. The 12 of them is Fichedi, Director of Finance, Mpakai, Director of Corporate Governance, Silaudi, Director of Internal Audit, Budi, Director of Investigation, Ngele, Provincial Head, Maharaj, Provincial Head of Investigations, Monobe, Provincial Head of Investigation MP, Njanga, the Provincial Head Gauteng, Musimane Khape, Provincial Head Investigations Northwest, Molope, Chief Director, Compliance Monitoring, Morosiwa, Chief Director, Legal Services, and Angus, Director, Investigation in Pumala. I need also to indicate that among those that do not have clearance as a SSA are some four members who have just been recruited from the SAPS, who had valid security clearances from the SSA. But the procedure is, we from the SSA being responsible to do vetting at all organs of state except the SAPS and the SNTF. If we are requested to do a vetting or determine the vetting status of officials in those departments, if we are not provided by the responsible department the status of the vetting of that official, we from our side declare that there is still no valid clearance. So those officials recruited from the SAPS by IP, according to us, they do not have valid clearances because there are procedures to be followed for us to confirm the clearance of a member issued by another national intelligence structure. So they have to follow certain procedures for us to be sure that the clearance that is issued conform to our requirements. So as as per the minimum information security standard, the security clearance is not automatically transferred. So thank you. Thank you,
thank you for your presentation. I think some of the information is really very problematic. I think next week we'll any of the secretary here, but I think we must also invite the head of IPED, the acting head, because it's quite clear that if there's key persons who even have submitted their forms and it's key persons staff, it's very problematic. Maybe a few questions from myself and then look also other members also coming. What I can't understand from the first part of your presentation, usually state security or NIA will have a liaison person who is responsible, or stakeholder manager, who is responsible for state departments. So that the person from NIA will be responsible to do the emergency liaison. Now, in terms of your version of the status of the secretariat, is there somebody from NIA or from state security who are responsible to manage that relationship? Because it's quite clear if the request was made in December and only in May now, there's clearly a problem. And so I want to know what is exactly the picture there. And then furthermore, with regard to IPEC, is there currently a relationship officer from state security? Because it seems clearly that there is a communication problem. If key staff, and in terms of your presentation, we don't even see the new appointed provincial S names that was released to this committee, what, 4 weeks ago? They're not even there. So if we can just get an indication, what is the status of that relationship? Because it clearly looks like broken communication. Honourable Malabachi.
Yeah. Chairperson, thank you very much. The presentation is very stressing. My third question is, what do you mean by saying the secretariat has not been available since December until May? What does that mean? My second one is, I see Sisoko, who is supposed to be the chief director investigation, is waiting, still in progress. It's also very worrying because he's supposed to be the chief head in that entity. My third one is, how long does it take to get a person? How long does it take? Thanks.
Thank you. Fine. Mumula.
Thank you, Chairperson. I can't understand when you say the civilian secretariat only sent 2 Z204 forms to you since 11 May 2015. Can you clarify it to me? And I'm having a problem because now you said the acting head of the executive director of the IPED doesn't have a valid security clearance. He's still on the line with those that are not. How is he going to take to be valid? Thank you, Chairperson.
No, thank you, Honourable Chair, and thanks for the presentation. Just to be clear about this question that I want to ask, you say that in terms of the Act, any other person that has been vetted outside of yourself, that certificate is rendered invalid. It's not necessarily valid because of the responsibility. So, should I deduct from that there may well be in the list that of the people that you have suggested that are on the board that are seen by you as not vetted, that they may have been vetted by other institutions, but not necessarily rendered vetted in terms of the mandate? Because I when you flip through the names, I could see some of the names of people who have been in the sector for some time. Some of them at the level of chief director where they were before. So my understanding has always been that the condition of final appointment is rest on the vetting. So the vetting must confirm the final appointment of SMS. So if this is what you're saying, can I deduct as well that the confirmation of appointment exclude the vetting? And if it does exclude the vetting and it was in a condition of employment that the confirmation is based on vetting, what does that mean? Because if a person failed the vetting, vetting also affects employment, for which a person was supposed to employ that. So really, I just want to know, what does this mean? Now, the people who, most of the investigators, I saw the list of 12 of them, most of them are sought from SEPs. Now, once assume that when they come from SEPs, they would come with some degree of vetting that have been vetted by SEPs before they assume the position where they were before. Now, you only mentioned 4 that they've just been employed. What do you say about the rest? Because most of them come from SEPs though, anyway. Are you still saying that all of them, with the current position they hold, that position is still defective as a result of the non-vetting aspect? And in general terms, in your understanding, what does this mean? Because this is a management tool in order to see whether people are able to work at the sensitive positions, including the chief financial officer. I mean, that's critical in terms of the vetting. Now, where does your responsibility start and end in respect of the vetting aspect? Because that's your responsibility. It's your responsibility to make sure that people are vetted. And now, if they're taking this drawn-out engagement, you know, I mean, what have you done from the 11th of December 2014 to the May this year? Because did you communicate with them? Did you write them letters? Did you give them basically saying, guys, this is now where it ends? I'm not hearing that. It's just been a kind of laser kind of thing that it may happen mañana, it can happen next year. So I just want to know from your responsibility aspect, because actually you are the one who must make sure that it happens. What from your side, what did you do to make sure that the secretariat played the game? I have an issue, but we will raise that issue with the secretariat when they come, because I don't understand. If the strategy says to the committee here in session, the delay is with state security. And we accept that, we call you here, and you're saying that actually it's not us, it's actually the secretariat. But that will deal with the secretariat when we meet with them next year. But I just want to know your role. What did you do as a responsible institution to make sure that people are vetted who work in a sensitive position in state? Thank you, Chair.
Hello, Mabisa.
Thank you, Chairperson. In fact, Honorable Ramatlakane have asked me, because I wanted to know how do they appoint without first vetting. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Dodd, you've alluded to the issue of capacity constraints inherent to the unit that does it. And that kind of touches with what Honorable Ramsakan has been alluding to. The issue around these units saying to us, be waiting for state security. Requests have been forwarded to expedite such, but there's no response. The issue of capacity in the unit itself, could that be the element of hindrance in enabling the unit to carry out its tasks within specific times? Or there are other factors alluded to, some of which by Honorable Ramatlakane. Thanks.
Honorable Mbele. Thank you, James. I mean, the presentation for me definitely speaks to the challenges of transversal management in governments, and having worked in provincial governments, I'm well aware of the inertias and the stop-start nature of many processes as you're trying to move things between departments and different units. So inwardly, the way to overcome that risk is to have transversal forums or a hub where things come together and all the relevant people can sort of discuss and make sure all the areas are covered. So my question is there a level or is there a forum at which all national departments have an opportunity to raise issues around security vetting, and in particular where issues are proactively followed up, where if there's been, as in this case, a request has gone through in December last year, it wasn't adequately sort of accompanied by all the required documents or information. At least then the state security agency at the level or at that forum can then proactively make follow-ups, because that's the only way to drive these things forward, is they have to be proactively followed up and not waiting for somebody to say what they're supposed to. And in particular, I would assume, but I could be incorrect, is the forum for that, or one of the forums for that, not the, the National Director General's Directors General Forum, so that the DGs, all the departments, can then say, listen, at least from the SSA, they say, we've got requests for this many applications from you, but we're missing this. When can you send them? We'll send them within 2 weeks. And on the other side, I could or whoever can say, we've sent you these applications. As far as we know, they are complete. When can we get an outcome? So I'm just interested in, at that systems management level, where is the platform or the forum where these things are meant to land, be communicated, and then conclude?
Thank you, Janice. I'm quite shocked at this presentation. The secretariat, the IPID, and the SATS have at one stage or another blamed your department, completely blamed you, for the fact that, for example, we've had crime intelligence with her clearance. We've had everyone, basically, that should have clearance, have at one stage or another not had clearance. There may be many more that actually we haven't asked about over the years, which really certainly didn't, Lazarus, any of them, provincial heads don't. At one stage, the National Police Commission didn't. I don't know if she now does have. It's utterly, utterly unacceptable. So they are blaming you. I mean, it's absolutely unequivocal. They're blaming you, but you're sitting here and you're blaming them. And you've clearly referred to the secretariat and IPIT, and you're saying they're not available, they're not sending you the certificate. And I will bet my bottom dollar they will come here and say, you're not available, they've sent everything through, and you're saying you haven't got it. It's because you don't have everybody in the same room, you could have cleared this up in 10 minutes. But we will be pinning it down, I'm quite sure. We need, you say unequivocally, the secretariat staff were not available to you from December last year until May. They did not answer you, they did not reply to you, they were not available, they were interested, they didn't send you the forms, and out of the entire staff, we've only got 2 forms. That is what you did here, you're nodding your head, you agree. So the civilian secretary, when they came here and said, no, well, everything's done and it's all with them, somebody's lying through their teeth is what's happened here in Parliament, and that's actually, this is like a sitting of the House of Parliament. To lie to Parliament is an extremely serious offence. So that's going to have to be looked into. So I just want absolute confirmation from you. The Secretariat, the IPID, the SAT, do you believe that they have been deliberately avoiding requesting clearance to be undertaken? If you do believe that, and I know you're stretching, well, I don't know how one has to see it like that from your side, I suppose, what possible reason are they avoiding this? Is it that their staff actually don't want to go through the process, they don't feel they'll get a valid certificate, maybe fired? That is a definite possibility. I'd like an answer from you. And once clearance is given by your division, how long is it valid for? And do you start vetting, if it's valid for a finite time, 5 years, do you then start vetting 6 months before the expiration of that certificate? in order that there's never a time of 3 months, 5 months, when a member who is in a particular position is actually illegally in that position because they don't have merit. And that again replies, is in relation to all two divisions, Secretariat, IBIT and the SAPS. Thank you.
Thank you very much, honourable members. Over to you, Mr. Lola.
Yes, Chairperson. Maybe I should start with the last question. When I started my presentation, I did indicate the responsibility and the mandate of the SSA. The SSA is responsible for vetting of all government departments except the SAGS and the SNGF, because the two are also mandated by law to conduct vetting of personnel within their area of responsibility. For the SSA to conduct vetting of officials in those areas, the SSA has to get a request from the SAGS or the SANDF requesting assistance with regard to vetting of their officials. We have received the request from the IBIT. We have received requests from the SAGS, from the Commissioner herself, maybe also to confirm, yes, the Commissioner has a valid clearance that was done by us. We did the vetting of all top officials of the SP, of the SAGS in 2013, 2014. We completed that project. We also received from the Secretariat, but as we all know, as I've indicated, the responsibility for vetting of the Secretariat is the responsibility of the SAGS vetting unit. I've interacted with the Secretariat to follow up on the request that they sent to us in December. I've communicated through my office on a number of occasions with evidence to the Secretariat to make herself available. But the Secretariat kept on saying yes, the next time the meeting is cancelled, and she then indicated to you, honourable members. The meeting only took place on the 11th of May, where I met with her. And then I explained to her what is required for them to do, for us to do a vetting. She gave me a list indicating that from October, November last year, she made her staff to fill in the necessary forms. Some submitted, some did not submit. I then requested her to give me the forms according to the list that she gave me, although so that we can start the process. From the 11th until today, as I've indicated, we set up a special project to work on this, as we've been doing with other requests from the SAGS. We've only received two completed Z204 forms. After having explained where, what it takes, and I said, this project will be completed within 4 weeks, but it's dependent on the availability and submission of relevant documentation to us. Then we can start the process, because we can't start the process if we don't have the necessary documentation. The validity of the clearance is 5 years for top secret and secret. But that 5 years is not a continuous 5 years. If anything, if the SSA picks up any issue that is a security issue that could compromise the security competence of an individual, that security clearance can be withdrawn at any time depending on the information available at that time. With regards to addressing issues of common concern among the three national intelligence structures, we do have a forum called the Counterintelligence Coordinating Forum, which meets on a quarterly basis. That consists of the SACS, the SNTF, the SSA, and other stakeholders that are mandated, but find themselves doing functions that talk to counterintelligence. Issues of concern are raised there and discussed there. The issue of capacity constraints, yes, we do have capacity constraints, but we are not letting everything to be affected by capacity. We do prioritize. Yes, we have a lot of requests. The capacity we have cannot match, but we do indicate to our executive authority with regard to this capacity constraint. But as we await the approval of our proposals to address the constraints, we prioritize. We set up projects to deal with the vetting of officials that are deemed to be a priority. And I can confidently say we've been able to do that. We have done that with the JSEI, where it took us about 2 weeks to complete the vetting of all JSEI members. So when there's a need, yes, we do it. But every day, we strive to maneuver within the capacity constraints that we have. The issue regarding when do we confirm an appointment of a person? Do we do that before vetting or do we do that after the appointment? We as the NSA, actually when we're near, around about 2005-2006, experienced a challenge where we could not manage the request as presented by Chapman for us to add them before, to add potential employees before employment. We even proposed, and it was approved by Cabinet in 2006, the National Vetting Strategy, that among others speaks about pre-employment screening in order to avert a situation where potential candidates stay long before they're appointed because the vetting process used to take long. So we propose and the cabinet approve the implementation of personnel suitability checks that requires an organ of state that wants to employ someone to conduct pre-employment screening, covering the background used in terms of the previous employer, education qualifications, and then we as the SSA are supposed to support the organs of state by providing them with criminal records from the SAPS, database from Home Affairs regarding the citizen's status of the candidate, and also to check on our own databases whether that person ever came across our attention. But it has been difficult for organs of state to comply because all organs of state are supposed to comply with capacitating themselves with personal suitability checks. It is understood and accepted that when a person is appointed in a position, he or she is appointed on condition that he or she will get a positive security clearance. So the basis of confirming the bona fide of a person before employment are done as pre-employment screening. Then the process of full vetting takes place depending on the position that the person is occupying. The time that takes for full vetting, it used to take long because of the processes. But the processes have been revised that made it easy to determine the security competence of a person without going a long route. So if all is made available, again I will try and flag the issue of capacity constraint. But if all is fine and the person requires a clearance immediately because of the position that he or she holds, the process can take more than 2 weeks. 2 weeks, you have done it. We are doing it. But because of the volumes of requests that we have, and on top of that, we also have, need to be honest with you, we have a lot of agent requests that come in. The agent requests end up affecting our plans in terms of how we intend dealing with getting off officials in Arkansas State. The acting head of IP, as far as our records indicate, as I've indicated to you, his clearance is still in process. It's not complete. And when we say he is in process, it depends at what level. It could be still busy with the field work while it's not available. Because I want to be honest with you, some top officials, they make themselves available. They didn't give an indication that they are ready. But when we consult them, they are unavailable. So unavailability and non-submission of relevant documents to complete the process delays the whole thing. If certain documents are required from you as an applicant and keep on reminding you until we put the file on the site and deal with other files, that file will remain in process. The other challenge that we face that we've always been flagging is the issue of access to SAPS criminal records. The cabinet decision of 2006 that I'm referring to clearly stated there that NIA at that time should establish a fingerprint unit within the SAPS. That meant that the SAPS had to train people and allocate offices to SSA members so that these members, because they're responsible for all government departments except the SAPS and SNTF, should be there and dedicated to service only there. But again, it has been more than 10 years. And teaching the SAPS to implement the decision taken by cabinet, it has been difficult. And that's one of the challenges that we face. Because for us, it's difficult to complete the vetting process without getting an indication of a criminal record of someone. But we have engaging, but as I say, it's been 10 years. And the SAPS seems not to be acceding to that demand from the cabinet. I've engaged everyone from the commissioner, and I've been giving promises that it will happen. It has not happened. We have even changed the, modified the cabinet decision by saying, can't you provide us with remote access as you do for IDECO? Because IDECO is a private company, can access SAPS records, criminal records. But we are not allowed by the SAPS. They simply refuse to give us that access. And it's having a serious delay in terms of us completing vetting of individuals. The other issue, which was the first question from the chair regarding are there any people allocated to the LAP, to the secretariat and the IP with regard to advising? We have come to an agreement with the IP. That's why we do have a security advisor attached to the IP to serve the needs of IP. But with the secretariat, because the secretariat, just like IP, basically is not our responsibility. We took it that the responsibility of the secretariat is the responsibility of the LAPS. Getting unit, from the crime intelligence. They've never indicated to us that they require assistance. So for us not to assign someone to the secretariat is not because we're not doing our responsibility, but it is not our responsibility to advise the secretariat on security-related issues. It is the responsibility of crime intelligence of the SAPS.
Responses, maybe just follow up from my side. I appreciate the information. If there is confirmation that IBET's got an advisor from your side, why do we have that long list of senior people that hasn't submitted the documentation? Isn't there bilaterals on a monthly or bi-monthly basis to look at us? Just maybe a response to that. I saw on Bukhara Vansa and on Mohamed Takani.
So you said it seems from your side that it is, has been, and I'm quoting you, difficult for orders of state to comply. As far as I know, this is not an optional extra. They have to do this. So it's not difficult for them to comply. They fill out the forms, they hand them to you. So they're treating the law with absolute and utter contempt. Really, I think we need a full detailed briefing on who should have clearance and who has actually applied. And how far this is stretched in terms of these entities that fall within the ambit of this portfolio. Secondly, this business of hiring people who then fail to get a clearance certificate and subsequently have to be booted out. How common is it? In your experience, how many people have been forced to leave? Let's say in the past 2 years, and I'm not asking for an exact figure, ballpark figure, is it common, is it rare, you know, that they fail their certificate. And if you have just guaranteed us you can get clearance certificate done in 2 weeks, what possible excuse can exist for the head of any division, be it the SATs or anywhere else, to appoint someone who needs a clearance certificate without getting one first before their appointment? I mean, is it not perhaps that certain heads want a particular person in a position knowing full well they won't get clearance, and then they do the dance around you for a year, not sending you that certificate, because they know full well that person will be booted out. Finally, you said you did the SAS top structure in 2013-14, and that now everyone has a clearance certificate. When you did that, that was now last year, did the National Peace Commissioner have clearance then, or had she then worked for 2 years without one?
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and thank you, Mr. Thurlow. Can I come back to my question? I just want to maybe share also with regard to evidence that there has been a communication from your office to the Secretariat that we should be finished with those kind of evidence. Communication that has gone from your office, because we would have to have a serious discussion with the Secretariat based on that. But on that question, my follow-up question is, as a responsible entity for vetting, understand the state security, understanding the implication of non-vetting in terms of the threat against the state, based on the mandate you have in terms of the act, the question is, what must you do? Is it possible you can go for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, while you are having friendly letters of exchange, conversation with manager X to supply? While I take it and accept that there are activities that are individual based, and the individual that are management based, activities are management based in terms of betting itself. But I want to ask straight from you, what do you do? What does the act empower you to do? Should you do nothing and continue exchanging of letters? Now, I just want to understand, because somewhere the buck must stop somewhere. Someone must be able to say, if you don't meet this, the implication of it is X. That implication may mean that those officials that are positions or placed in certain positions would cease to be in those positions at the date X if they have not complied with X. So I want to know what do you do, because the bus in terms of rating stops with you, and you can't have a nice conversation forever with the people that do not want to comply. So I want to know, is a vacuum, is a gap in terms of the power, in terms of legislation, that does not necessarily enables you to say, we want to guillotine falls here if you don't do this. That's really what I want to know, because if there is such a thing, then we have another problem. That we can have the department that's supposed to do, would basically doesn't have the teeth to be able to perform this function that it needs to perform in terms of the legislation. And I just want to, if you can, and really the last issue for me on this question is that, and I think you take it as it comes, we're not necessarily squeezing you, we just trying to understand, so that you empower us to engage with others. Sometimes the minimum security, there was this whole provision that every entity organs must have this security advisor attached to security to manage the risk. And it was the responsibility of NIA at that point to make sure that it happens. Is that being implemented? Is that not necessarily being implemented? And I think maybe later when we talk to you again, what are the threats that you are hearing, or maybe not you, but in your engagement with SEPs around this unit in the police itself? I find it strange that in 10 years there has been this ping pong, there has been this game played, not being implemented, when there is authority saying this must happen again. If that happens, at what point is this matter being escalated to some authority that would say, guys, we've been talking for too long, this shall now happen? So I find that maybe you understand what I'm saying, the point I'm trying to make to you, and I'm trying to make it as friendly as possible. But let me pause there, Chair, and I just really want to understand these three things.
There is this notion that if I know myself that I have criminal record, and when I want, when you, I'm supposed to submit my fingerprints, I use hash on my phone. Is that really happening?
Much members, there's no other urgent question. Thank you very much. Mr. Dolo, over to you.
The last question, maybe I'm not the expert on this, but I will take it that if an instance like that happens, it is the issue that the SAPS will deal with when they receive the request, the fingerprints. They will match the fingerprint and the name, and then they will indicate to us. But so far, we, from our side, we haven't experienced that situation. Yes, we have experienced situations relating to fraudulent qualifications in terms of academic and fraudulent activities with regards to fraudulent IDs, which when we pick it up as our procedure, we forward that to the SAPS for the SAPS to pursue and make a criminal charge on the matter. The issue regarding management of security at Organs of State is an issue, as you've indicated, given to the SSA to manage. The SSA has been managing that issue by making sure that all Organs of State appoint security managers. And so far, I can safely say close to 80 to 90% have appointed security managers, and those security managers are appointed as per our guidelines in terms of who should be appointed as a security manager. We as the SSA have also established a forum where all security managers from the different sectors of government, the state-owned entities and national government and provincial government, have a forum where issues of concern and imparting the necessary knowledge in terms of what is required for security manager. We do have those forums. The issue regarding action expected from the SSA with regard to non-compliance. I should say that the SSA's role is to advise the head of the institution, the accounting officer, who at the end, he or she is the person responsible to take action. We do on a regular basis do security audits at organs of state, indicating gaps, including people that might be employed without the relevant security clearance. And we submit those reports to heads of institutions to implement. But every time when they're supposed to implement, there are issues of budgetary constraints that they cannot do 1, 2, 3 because they do not have the necessary budget. But we play that role of advising organs of state with regard to issues relating to security. The issue relating to evidence relating to correspondence.
Point of clarity, if you wouldn't mind one moment. I'm sorry, you just said that divisions tell you there's an issue of budget. I thought they simply had to fill out a form. I can't understand what the budget issue is that they're claiming the delays about.
I'm talking about other security-related gaps identified during audits that require financial resources to address.
Yes.
The evidence relating to that correspondence with the Secretariat will be provided to you because it's there. The issue regarding the security status of the commissioner before we issued the clearance, as I've indicated, we as the SSA are responsible for all except SAPL and SANDF until we receive a request from that institution to assist them with the vetting of their officers. So prior to that, I cannot confirm that the commission did have or did not have a clearance because we did not do a clearance. We only did a clearance in the last year or so. That's all from
me. It's just that one issue. I just wanted to get clarity on if there is now in terms of your evidence and relationship manager for IPAC, why is there that lack in follow-up? I mean, there must be constant meetings. For instance, if there's a list of 10 senior people who haven't even submitted their documents, what is the role of the security advisor? Honorable Ramatakane.
Honorable Chair, it's just a small, really small question. That you say your role is to advise and head of institution, their role is to implement. Is it to advise or is to basically make a recommendation that now, advice you either take it or you don't. I'm just trying to find out exactly. It may well be a issue of what is expected from that advice. Now, maybe if you can help me to understand that role exactly, because the mandate must be very clear mandate in terms of this.
Honorable Kalibanat, anything from you?
Asked if we could have some idea of how many people had been appointed and then subsequently the clearance certificate was refused, or I don't know what the correct term is in relation to the certificate, how many people they had to vacate those positions in the relevant organs of state. And I also asked how long, for example, it would take to determine whether or not the latest acting head of the Hawks, for example, would be given a certificate.
I think in relation to the first question, I think it will be impossible to, and that will have to do, a bit of research will have to be done. But you're welcome, Mr. Stone.
Indicated the chairperson is going to be difficult for me to provide that information at the go. I will make a promise to come back and give you in detail as to exactly what happened with regard to those that have been denied. But the issue of the advice that we give to accounting officers in Ogun State is for them to act. Maybe, don't know whether I would be correct. It is the responsibility of the head of an institution to understand the implications of not abiding by the recommendations made. Yes, it can appear that is recommendations. By the impact that those recommendations are not implemented, what will that do to your institution? It is up to the accounting office to make that assessment the same. I see these are recommendations. But if I don't implement this, I'm likely to operate in a situation, in an environment that is not conducive for me to achieve my objectives. So it is up to the accounting officer to take that into account and say, to what extent does this impact on the environment in which I'm working so that I can achieve my objectives?
A question from my side, the follow-up. In terms of the testimony, I prescribed as a security advisor. Why is there no follow-up? I mean, that's my concern. I mean, it must be what's been the job of that person in that business alone.
There is a follow-up. There is a follow-up, as I've indicated. It's not only IP that we are getting. The follow-up is done on a regular basis by the security manager in conjunction with our security advisor. And then we try and push. To be honest, I said it's capacity constraints. There are so many requests that we juggle among and prioritize. Yes, we are giving attention in terms of attending to those that are in process. But there is communication between the two.
I didn't have an answer to whether or not they were doing the head of the acting, whoever he is, acting head of horse. It's a certificate concern.
The SSA has not as yet received a request from the SAPS to do a vetting on the acting head of the horse.
Thank you very much, honorable members. Thank you, Mr. Dolo, for your appearance before the committee. I think this will assist us in our further interaction next week with the secretariat. We'll also invite Mr. Khamenei to the committee, because it's quite clear that there needs to be a much more concerted effort from those departments to ensure that state security has got the necessary information to deal with those vettings. But we will also want to urge SSA to prioritize the acting edge as well as the SMS group, as indicated in our report that was titled in Parliament. That's quite important, because we can't have a situation where two oversight institutions that are responsible for SATs do not have the necessary information. Furthermore, it was a testimony in that engagement from the Secretariat that they are not able to get information from SATs due to the fact that they've got security clearances of that hampers their work. But it's quite clear from today we will have to get further explanations from the Acting Secretary, because if their staff are not submitting the documentation and forms, it's not acceptable, and there must be disciplinary steps taken against those officials by the Acting Secretary and also in the Coast Guard. Because people, if they want to be in sensitive roles, have to have clearance. That's the bottom line. And they must assist SSA in doing that. So thank you very much for your presentation, members. We will take a 5-minute break, and then we'll invite the Deputy National Commissioner and his delegation. Thank you.
I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to
Honourable members, 2 minutes. Focus especially on those issues
with the Child Justice Act, but also looking at reduced incidence of crimes against vulnerable groups, including women, the LGBTI community, and also including foreign nationals. So that's really our focus today. Members received a briefing document as well as a research document from the members, as well as this green research report that was done in the previous parliamentary term that I think also spells out the legislative environment. So I think members are quite afraid, but it's quite important for us as a portfolio committee to monitor this process. The issue of children in custody is a burning issue, and it's a difficult issue. And all role players involved should assist there. So we'll look at all those things. All those things are covered in the chat's presentation, and we'll give ample opportunity for members to raise issues. Welcome, General Sithole. I think the members already introduced themselves in the previous session, so I think it's fine, and I think General Sithole's team might know also the members from previous interactions, but if there's new members, please indicate. We'll introduce them. General Sithole, I'll give over to you and your team.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, and good morning to all Honorable members. Just thanking you for the opportunity, Honorable Chair. I would like to just quickly start by introducing the sub-delegacy, which is here with me, and also just tailoring an apology for the National Commissioner. With me is Major General Mkhlana, who is the Acting Divisional Commissioner for Visible Policing. I think Visible Policing is the lead division for the implementation of this Act. And I also have Major General Pinar, who is a component head under Crime Prevention for this particular Act. You can just raise your hand so that I can see you. Then I have Major General Rochelon, who is in charge of the child protection and family violence from detectives. Then I've got Major General Johnson, who's responsible for general investigations. Thank you. Then I have Brigadier Nadi, who's the head for children and vulnerable groups with the Invisible Policy. I have Brigadier M.M. Silunella, who's the head for gender-based violence with the Invisible Policy. And I have Brigadier Van Roy, who's from the Life Services working with our parent participants. The last member is Lieutenant Colonel K.B. Spain, who is administering our process report for the committee. Just briefly, Chairperson, this particular Act has got 9 objectives in the face of its implementation, and 6 of the 9 objectives are relevant, are directly relevant to the police. As you correctly outlined in the beginning, this Act cut across a number of stakeholders within and outside us, which then enters the National Crime Prevention Strategy. And then this particular Act is also read with 2 other legislations which are cutting across it. The one is the Sexual Offences Act. The second of the objectives of this Act, which also cuts across the funds. Then the other next legislation is the Children's Act. Those objectives are also cutting across this Act. So as we implement it, we do not lose sight of those. And as we also implement this Act, we then observe the National Crime Prevention Strategy, which makes a broader provision and field, and as well as the NDP, which has its own division 2030 certification that also talks to children. But the implementation of this Act is taking place at 2 levels. We have a multidisciplinary implementation plan, which involves all the stakeholders that are working together with us, especially from the criminal justice process. Then we have an integrated SAPS implementation plan. Integrated SAPS implementation plan is the one that is addressing the areas where staff is directly involved, but it's going to multidisciplinary one. And with this particular explanation and with your permission, Chair, our presentation as it is directly from the SAS integrated plan, though also speaking to the multidisciplinary process, is going to be led by General Pina. Thank you, Chair.
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. I'm going to pick up where General Sitole left off and start speaking to the minimum requirements for implementation of the Act, and that was identified in the Police Implementation Plan. The first of those was the need to, for police to develop and implement a national instruction in terms of Section 97.5 of the Act, and also to contribute to the development of a national policy framework that guides the implementation across all departments. National Instruction 2 of 2010 was developed and implemented. This National Instruction was also as request as required table to Parliament and debated, and this was in place by June 2010. From April to June 2010, when the Act was first implemented, we had an international instruction in place. Police also then contributed to the development of the National Police Framework, which has since been promulgated. Then we had to deal with the training and capacity building of the members in terms of our responsibilities included in the Act, also in line with the objectives of the Act that General Sitole outlined. This includes ensuring that police is capable to secure attendance in court, including attendance of a child offender at a preliminary inquiry, and that deals with the arrest of a child offender, the notice for the offence and summons to appear in court, to notify the probation officer so that the child can be assessed, and responsible adult in terms of Section 17 to 20 of the Act. The training curriculum was developed, training conducted, and it's still ongoing. We still do in-service training, and we have also included provision for this Act in the basic training course, but not the complete course. We do two programs that specifically deal with children, the Vulnerable Children Learning Program, which is a five-day course that deals specifically with this Act and the Children's Act. And we also have a Children and Youth at Risk program that speaks to prevention aspects, how we deal with child with preventing children from offending and children from being at risk. Then in terms of our responsibilities, the training also provides for police responsibilities to release a child who is a responsible adult or to secure care and when necessary to detain, and to conduct investigations, including the determination of whether the child was used by an adult to commit a crime, which is a separate offence. Then, in terms of the details of time, the number of members starts on the date of the implementation of the Act, which is in April 2010. The first year, we focused quite a lot on reaching as many people as possible, specifically also cascading the training to the provincial officers, the cluster and station officers, so that we wanted to make sure that every cluster and every station at least had some capacity that could also inform other members in terms of implementation. We also trained legal officers, and that was in the first year, the number was 20,683 members trained. Some of that training was the five-day course, but some of it was also a shorter course, a one-day course that basically served to inform members of their responsibility to make them aware that a new act had come into place. 2011-12, the training figure was 9,099. This is basically for in-service training. 2012-13, 5,898. 2013-14, 6,927. And in the last financial year, the current figure is an interim figure that will still be audited and may change when we publish the annual report, but was 4,422. So the total number of police members trained since the Act was implemented was 47,519. In terms of the Act, police must also implement in the establishment and functioning of the One-Stop Child Justice Centres. Police currently participate in all the existing or established One-Stop Child Justice Centres. That includes the Marina Centre in the Eastern Cape, the Success of the Livingstone Centre, which is a good practice model, the Mount Home Centre in Freestadt, Jubarton in Rustenburg, and Mount Kenya in Northwest. We're currently busy working with the other departments in finalising the service level agreement for the Matlosana One-Stop Child Justice Centre that's currently being finalised for Northwest. In terms of monitoring implementation of the Act and also the requirements in terms of the Act, police must provide statistics quarterly to the Intersectoral Committee on Child Justice on the number of charges or crimes specifically on sexual offences. That was a specific initiative in terms of monitoring from the Interdepartmental Committee that we provide details of sexual offences charges against children. We provide this information that is aggregated by province age and station. We then also enhanced our operational planning and monitoring system to provide for capturing of information pertaining to children under 10 who cannot be charged, if the information cannot be captured on the current administration system. But we must capture that we dealt with such a child and referred him to a probation officer. So we've enhanced the ARAM system to provide for that. This was rolled out nationally in February 2015. So in the next, at the end of the current financial year, we would for the first time be able to get an annual figure of children under 10 referred to probation officers by police. Such representatives participate in the Director General Intersectoral Committee for the Child Justice Act, and we also participate in the Operational Intersectoral Child Justice Committee. These committees function at national and provincial level, and what is very important from a national monitoring perspective is that as the provincial committees meet and all the departments participate, issues that they cannot resolve at provincial level is escalated to the national level. So from provinces, we would get a provincial representative serving in the national meetings that would raise with us in police specific concerns. For instance, if they deal with the police station where they're concerned about where the members are probably trying to raise at a national level, and we can then intervene. Communication and awareness on programs on the Act, the legislation, the national instruction, children in conflict with the law, and the national instruction for children in need of care protection in terms of Children's Act is available on police intranet, and we've also distributed in terms of formal police distribution of national instructions. We do public education awareness program campaigns, including radio broadcasts with GCIN and with the other departments, and presentations made to children. And this happens on an ongoing basis from station to the provincial and national level. Interventions to accelerate training of personnel. On a cumulative basis, we do in-service training to ensure there's a large number of personnel that needs to be trained. Members move from post to post, so you would find that you've trained members at a station, but someone is promoted or go to another station. So there's an ongoing need to ensure that every police station I have an adequate number of members trained in this act, so that at least on every shift we have a trained person that can also guide other members in terms of dealing with children. And we expect stations and us to do certain and faster lectures and conduct work sessions in terms of sound practices. It's also important for other local level that work with the other departments and other institutions that are available in their area. So we encourage them to have local working arrangements with other departments and to conduct work sessions that speak specifically to how they're going to do with children in that area, how they will relate to the child and youth care centers in the area, the probation offices in the area, and what other service providers might be available in the area. Then in terms of the total number of charges against children in the Implementation Policy Act, we have captured on the next slide both the total charges, and that is basically all charges where the offender was a child under 18 and above 10, or 10 and above, and we've also captured the number of sexual offences. So in the first year of implementation, the total number of charges against children was 75,435, sexual offences charges 4,671. In the second year, 68,078 total charges, 4,772 sexual offences charges. In the third year of implementation, we had 57,721 overall charges and 4,960 sexual offences charges. And in the 2013-14 year, we had 47,274 overall charges and 2,943 sexual offences charges. The final figures for the current financial year is not yet available. What we did in the next slide is to compare the police information also to the published information for the other departments, and you'll see that in 2013-14 we didn't have the other departments' information available yet, because although that report has been tabled to Parliament, it wasn't published yet. But we determined that the figures are available, so we can update this information for you. But it charges in relates to also the number of children assessed. So in the first year, 32,500 children were assessed. Now, police captured charges against children, so one child might face more than one charge. So there will never be a complete correlation with these figures, but it gives an indication of the number of children that move from subcharging them to being assessed by a probation officer. And then of the cases, 16,452 were cases that qualified for diversion and were actually undergoing diversion programs. In the next year, we had 68,000 charges, of which 18,334 children were assessed, and then 9,192 cases were diverted. When it's the 12-13, from the charges, we went to 32,125 cases children assessed, and the cases diverted 11,420. As indicated, the figures for 2013-14 has not been published yet, but they are available, and we will update this information as soon as the information is made available. Mr. Chair, I want to hand back to General Sawley just for the concluding remarks on this act.
Thank you very much, Justice. Just the a few remarks on the monitoring and evaluation side. Firstly, we have linked the monitoring and evaluation of the implementation of this act to the CAS system. We were able to check through the CAS whether the charging is correct, and if it's not charged, we're able to pick it up and take the necessary corrective measures. And this particular system has now graduated into the ICMS, which is a little bit more advanced than CAS, and it enhances our capacity for monitoring and evaluation. We're also using the OPM system to enhance this particular monitoring. And from the side of the detectives, we are also monitoring the remand detainees together with the correctional services. Then we have also issued supplementary orders to the national instruction so that we make sure that all stations, they follow this particular process step by step without any omissions. We also conduct station visits, and this is also linked to the factory visits that we have introduced. We then developed addendums within the performance management, and this has been added to the performance contracts of provincial commissioners, cluster commanders, right up to station level, so everyone is made up in terms of this. The inspectorate has been given from the national instruction, including all the orders, and then it's linked to the service evaluation. We get the reports. And by the way, within the inspectorate, we've also introduced the compliance board. And if there's any area of non-compliance, then address it through the compliance board so people appear an account. The last part, we are also doing feasibility analysis on the act, where we pick in areas that require attention at both operational level and those that we could escalate up to the level of either the portfolio committee, the ministry, and above, which could influence either some certain changes in the act or maybe supplementary orders or regulations or any others. I think this is how far we can go with the presentation, and thank you very much for the opportunity.
Honourable Chairperson, you want to continue with the next part of the presentation? No problem. Okay, no problem. The next part of the presentation then focuses on efforts made to decrease crimes against vulnerable groups. The relevant legal framework that applies in this case, we try to just give an overall indication of the legislation that specifically deals with vulnerable groups, which starts with the Constitution and particularly the Bill of Rights in the Constitution. The Domestic Violence Act, also Common Law Offences, Criminal Law, Sexual Offences and Related Matters Amendment Act, the Children's Act, the Child Justice Act, the Forms and Publications Act, and the Other Persons Act. Also applicable international obligations, both in terms of the United Nations and the African Union Conventions. Then we have relative SAPS instructions, 7 of 99 on the Domestic Violence Act, 3 of 2008 on sexual offences, 2 of 2010 on children in conflict with the law, that's the one that relates to the Child Justice Act, 3 of 2010 on care and protection of children in terms of the Children's Act, 2 of 2012 on victim empowerment, and follows also from the National Victims Charter, 1 of 2014 on the protection of older persons, and then standard operating procedures for reporting of victim-related crimes. The policing approach utilized in terms of dealing with crimes against vulnerable groups is proactive in terms of prevention, reactive investigation, and also ensuring multidisciplinary cooperation with other departments and institutions. Proactive policing is done in the following four areas: early intervention, victim support services, implementation of legislation and policies in respect to vulnerable groups, and awareness programs involving, in particular, in this case, schools, communities at large, and through the media. In terms of proactive policing, early interventions addresses the prevention and commission of further crimes, the identification and reporting of crimes. If we don't get people to report, then we don't have an accurate indication of how prevalent that crime is and what the nature of the contributing factors are. So we really try to focus on getting people to report crimes so that we can get a better analysis of what drives that crime are. The identification and apprehension of offenders. Crime analysis at local cluster and provincial level to inform policing actions and how we deploy our personnel and what kind of intervention action we need to undertake. Intervention plan and projects with stakeholders, for instance, community safety plans with community reach forums and outreach programs. terms of Victim Support Services, we address the training of police members to deal with victims and deal sensitively with victims to prevent secondary victimization. The provision of victim-friendly facilities at police stations, which include victim support rooms, but also include other forms of structural change to police stations to make them victim-friendly. That includes making stations disability-friendly with ramps. It also includes provision, for instance, for one-way glass at rooms where we conduct identity parades. Cooperation with victim service providers, and for instance, the NGOs that provide victim services, so that we can have a referral to victim services in their area. A national summary on the next slide is provided of the current state of the victim-friendly rooms where the services are provided. I'm not going to read through all the figures, but essentially at police stations we have 897. At satellite police stations, 36, and you've got an indication there of how they're distributed per province. At contact points, we have one. A lot of the contact points have subsequently become satellite police stations, or satellite police stations have become police stations, so we invest mostly in our police stations. At the international airport, the three international airports all have, Durban, Tasman and Owatamba all have the victim-friendly rooms. HTS units have 32 rooms overall. Railway police, contact points, or even sometimes the coaches at the long-distance trains have victim-friendly rooms. There's 20 of them in place at the moment. And the total number of facilities in provinces with all these, the breakdown is 989 currently. Then, police also work very closely with other departments and other service providers that provide one-stop services. So the two main examples of one-stop service centers that are currently available in terms of victims of vulnerable victims, vulnerable group victims, is the Zera Care Center that's focused specifically on sexual offenders and the Kusileka one-stop centers that are established by DSD. Currently, there are two to Zera Care Centers in the country. And we've tried to indicate how police stations link up with those digital centers. So in the East Coast, for instance, 53 police stations might use the service of the 8 digital centers that are currently in place. In the Free State, there are 36 stations that feed into 4 digital centers. And this is essentially where the police station can refer victims to those digital centers for assistance, whether it is counseling or whether it is to facilitate the medical examination from there. But essentially, it means the station works links to that Zela Care Center. Often, we also have an arrangement where the FCS unit is linked to that Zela Care Center so that we will get a victim to the Zela Care Center as soon as possible, and everything else will happen at that center, including the detective going there to take their statement. KZN 63 stations linked to 8 Zela Care Centers, in Limpopo 35 stations linked to 6 Zela Care Centers, in Mpumalanga 29 linked to 5, Northern Cape has 25 stations that feed into 4 Zela Care Centres, and Northwest 31 into 5. Western Cape 57 police stations feeding into 5 Zela Care Centres. Then similar in terms of the one-stop centres for Kusileka centres, however they are fewer of them currently. 23 of those Kusileka, 23 police stations are linked to 3 of the Kusileka one-stop centres in Eastern Cape. 97 police stations are feeding into one of them in Limpopo. 13 in Northwest feed to 2 Kusileka one-stop centers, and that's overall 1 to 3 stations that are served by the 6 current existing centers. In Limpopo, obviously, you'll see that there's a lot of stations. Not all the service happens at the one-stop center. A lot of the service delivery wouldn't happen at a police station, but that would refer to for additional services to the one-stop center. Further in terms of proactive policing and the implementation of legislation and policies in respect of vulnerable groups. In terms of the protection of persons with disabilities, police participate in the National Disability Machinery Committee that helps with disability rights, monitoring, as well as ensure improved access to services to persons with disabilities. Our guidelines on policing of crimes against people with disabilities in the process has been finalised. We've got a task team that in place constituted in 29 on 29 April to work towards development of a disability policing strategy in order to ensure improved services to persons with disability. We work specifically also with our EHW capacity in that regard because they have specific expertise and they're also linked to the other interdepartmental programs linked to people with disabilities and the international conventions in that regard. On the protection of older persons, police participate in the South African Older Persons Forum in order to ensure improved protection services to the elderly. The guidelines on the protection of older persons is developed and members will be capacitated on it in this financial year. National Instruction 2 of 2014 on the protection of older persons was developed and rolled out in 2014. The participation in the forums is also important because often those structures that feed into these national machineries or forums allow us to get complaints or specific concerns raised with police on in areas where there are problems so that you can follow that up. the protection of older persons, identification on the lesbian, bi, bisexual, transgender, and intersex community, the LGBTI community. Police collaborated with other operators to develop the following in an effort to reduce incidents of crimes against the LGBTI community. We developed terms of reference for national task team that's led by the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. With terms of reference developed for a rapid response team that allows us to follow up specific incidents or incidents of crimes against the LGBTI community. There's a national intervention strategy developed, and we've developed an information pamphlet on frequently asked questions regarding LGBTI persons. Protection. This is the deputation. Okay. The SOPS has ongoing campaigns aimed at raising the awareness of the public on issues that impact child prostitution, child pornography, and child trafficking, or the sad children. In this manner, the campaign is applicable as a strategy to prevent other subject-specific child abuse and exploitation issues. They are school bus visits by police officers that are aimed at raising children's awareness of child abuse matters and they need to report these to a trusted adult and the police. These engagements are also aimed at promoting awareness of positive behavior that counters issues such as bullying, the use of drugs, use of weapons, age-inappropriate sexual engagement, and the need to report inappropriate behavior towards children. These police officers are known as doctor cop officials, and they have over the years also conducted awareness shows at various other places that children are found, such as shopping malls, during weekend space, bazaar, and agricultural sales town. What is important in the school is that police work in this area with the education authorities. So we wouldn't go into school and present content that hasn't been agreed with the school. So that's part of our ongoing collaboration with education on safe schools. Police use promotional material that focuses on placing specific child protection messages on objects such as rulers, such as colouring books and gist marks, pamphlets, verses and other information and awareness raising material that is produced and distributed to the public to prevent, to provide child abuse prevention information and rise child protection awareness. Also because there are obligations, for instance, on schools if there should be child abuse that they have to report in terms of the legislation. We need to inform people of their obligations in terms of specifically the Children's Act. Public awareness events are conducted on an ongoing basis and peak period focus periods such as during Child Protection Week, which starts at the end of next week, and 16 days of activism of no violence with women and children, and electronic and media engagement also outlines service available from the police for early intervention of OCC for the child abuse. On LGBTI issues, police conduct national and provincial public education awareness campaigns to inform the public about harms against vulnerable groups, women, children, elderly, and the LGBTI community. The purpose is to educate the public and by doing so to encourage reporting and prevent ongoing incidents of crime. On gender-based violence in general, police has distributed the following communication materials in 2014-15 financial year to enhance public education awareness in all communities. Domestic violence pamphlet in all 11 official languages. Sexual offences record in all official languages, and these explain basically the responsibilities of the police and rights of the victim. Children's rights leaflets, school safety booklets, banners and posters on school safety drugs and the Children's Act. On the investigation of crimes, the majority of crimes are sexual offences investigated by the detectives attached to the 176 family violence self protection and sexual offences units based in each cluster area. The environment has 2,529 members, of which 2,242 are Police Act members and 287 are Public Service Act members, comprised of detectives investigating cases and social workers specializing in forensic work in areas with a high prevalence of need. The training and development focuses on generic courses like basic training, domestic violence program, resolving of crime, basically the program that teaches detectives and the sexual offences program. And in specialized courses, which is the FCA Detective Learning Program that specifically focuses on the training of detectives in that environment and forensic social work program. The units were established in terms of the cluster model of 176 clusters, so we're currently 27 in the Eastern Cape, 18 in Free State, 22 in Gauteng, 25 in KwaZulu-Natal, 15 in Limpopo, 15 in Mpumalanga, 16 in Northern Cape, 12 in Northwest, and 25 in Western Cape. Multidisciplinary cooperation in this area. Police work very closely with other government departments, including the Justice and Constitutional Development Department, responsible for the Sexual Offences and Related Management, Related Matters Amendment Act, the LGBTI program, the Child Justice program, and the Domestic Violence program. Social Development, that leads specifically the Child Protection and Victim Empowerment program. Home Affairs, that's also responsible for the Health and Public Relations Board, and we work with them specifically also on child pornography issues. The Interministerial Committee on Gender-Based Violence, with Interpol in terms of gender-based violence, where we also deal with offenders that commit offenses in multiple countries. and with NGOs and community-based organizations that provide services specifically to victims in this field. Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson.
Yeah, Honourable Chair, thanks. Certainly, in wrapping up, we also designing a policy matrix for such. And that deals with the vertical and horizontal coordination of all policies and legislations. And the, how it helps us, the responsibility to implement a specific legislation does not lie within one environment in the sense. It links all the environment as you go through that particular legislation. And therefore, this prescribes a requirement for all those environments to work together and come up with action plans. But again, we're also able to identify the role of the other disciplines outside traps, and then we link them to that particular process. And it then also helps us to identify the intervention specifications, the type of plans that we should put in place, because they are clearly defined in those legislations. In order to enhance multidisciplinary that is collaboration, we also implemented National Crime Prevention Strategy. We've been going to all the provincial governments in the country, but we've already covered six, and the four of the system have already developed their provincial crime prevention frameworks. And then where all the teams are able to work together. We've also developed youth crime prevention frameworks, which also drill down to link, that is, the children. And we are also doing this with the provinces. I think just the last two summits were held in the Northwest and the state. And we use these frameworks to enhance further multidisciplinary collaboration. And where this national country strategy process has almost been fully implemented, it's seen in the Free State, which is currently performing above all the provinces in fighting crime. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much for the presentation. We will now go to questions. We'll start with that side. General Sikole, while you're here, it may be an adjoint issue, but I think from the committee side, I think we note the progress that's been made with Operation Vela. I mean, I see a lot of illegal firearms have been confiscated, other contraband and arrested of wanted criminals and so on. If we as a committee can just get a short update, I mean, we will later ask maybe for more comprehensive presentation at a later date, but there was also some organizations that raised some concerns regarding the operation. If you can just maybe give us again the assurance that in terms of the human rights approach, in terms of the rights approach, you know, there is sufficient safety measures on the ground when conducting these operations, that people are dealt with in line with the Constitution and in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act. If you can just maybe, you know, indicate those steps, that we've got an assurance that everything is done in terms and in line with the Constitution. So if we can just a snapshot. Let's go through questions. Honourable Kola Barnard.
Thank you. There seem to be a number of difficulties in terms of reporting of figures. Let's start with how is it we're supposed to work out whether or not all children are being assessed by a probation officer within 48 hours? Where are those figures? And really, horrific as it sounds, how many children under 10 are in conflict with the law? Are they being sent to probation officers? What are the numbers? How many 10 to 13-year-olds are sent to the Department of Health for assessment on whether or not they have criminal capacity? That's all in the Act. And I'll just say four or so. How many children are being diverted before the preliminary inquiry? That is also set out in the Act. But we're looking for the numbers. They just don't seem to be available. And the determination has to be, are there more or fewer children coming into conflict with the law that are going to trial? Because it did seem to be on an upward curve.
What kind of bias am I on the bill?
Thank you, Chairperson. I've got several questions and comments, some more straightforward than others, so I'll just work through them steadily. The first one is on page, slide 14, in that table about victim-friendly rooms and victim-friendly services rendered. Can I just get clarity on what the role of contact points refers to exactly, because there's only one of them, and I'm just curious what that is, what it does, and what the implications are of there being only one in the country. Just clarity on that. My second question is, my second question is in terms of the efforts to reduce crimes concerning the LGBTI community. Now, a couple of questions around that. The first is, there was mention made of the terms of reference within the chapter's role in the terms of reference of the National Task Team and the Rapid Response Team. I've looked at the National Intervention Strategy documents in relation to that. It's term vague on what the role of the SATS is, specifically in this regard. Could you please just elaborate on that, or clarify if it's simply saying that SATS should perform its usual functions within that scope. The other thing that's quite distressing is that both in terms of the section on protection of persons with disabilities on slide 16, and then in relation to the LGBTI community on page on slide 18, they both make mention of a task team being constituted on the 29th of April 2015, and then the National LGBTI program being officially launched on 29 April 2015. This is basically at the end of last month. So the cynic in me says that when the SATS received the request from the committee to brief on these matters, there was a massive scramble to cobble something together so that it could be said a process has been initiated or within the process, hence this very recent starting date. Can I be alleviated of that concern or clarity given as to what the reason for that is? But particularly with reference to the LGBTI program that's this year to have been launched on 29 April, I mean, the national task team, in terms of a response to hate crimes against LGBTI people, that started in March 2011. And I know this because both the National Intervention Strategy document says, in March 2011, the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development mandated the establishment of a national task team to develop a national intervention strategy that would address creative rape. So the document says it. I also know this because at the time I was working for an NGO, one of whose programs was LGBTI rights, and that was when these discussions were happening. There was a meeting with the minister, so I was there for the birth of the thing. And if a program is only being officially launched on the 29th of April last month, that's a bit of a problem. So what's the reason for that, four-year gap between the initiation and something becoming official? A big explanation behind that, please. And then my last question for now is on slide 23. There's the provincial breakdown of clusters, the operational clusters for SATS. In at least one instance, this information is not correct, because just earlier on this year, the Western Cape's clusters, according to the information that I have recently been reduced from 25 to 16. And that's been in the local community media of my constituency. And this first came to me because resident associations were very unhappy with the reduction of the number of classes affecting them in my constituency, and wondering what that will mean for policing services delivery. So just a bag. This is outdated and inaccurate data, at least insofar as the Western Cape clusters are concerned. And what has been the reason for the reduction of clusters? Because I'm yet to get a clear and rational explanation as to why that approach was taken, so that if for no other reason, I can also communicate that to my constituents and how they can be relayed going forward and not be concerned about the impact on your public safety from that. Thank you.
Honourable Ben Amotwa, you're fine. Honourable Mavija, Honourable... Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to clarify two things. On page, it is talked about SAP's instructions. I just want to understand what is the difference between the instructions by SAP's or as against legislation. And the sexual offences is at cuts. What would that be? Thank you, Chairperson.
Very much, Honourable Ramaphosa.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and thank you to the Commissioner. The presentation, I think, is quite useful in terms of just taking stock of what type of work has been done. But may I just have just few small questions? The first one, in terms of the general questions here, is you do have this one-stop center, but in the event that you don't have, I just want to have a little bit of understanding in terms of your victim support centers that could stand in the vacuum of where you don't have the one that's one-stop center. What's the footprint of that in terms of the country generally? It's good that I see 47,000 trained the police officer already. I think that goes a long way. But normally sometimes this training, it happens, but it's unsustainable because the very personnel that has been trained moves from the center of training to something else. I just want to find out, can we get some assurance that these are excellent specialization, if you like, if a lack of better term, specialization in respect of this implementation of this child act. Then it would be useful just to get maybe Commissioner going forward the type of children in conflict with the act. What are we talking? So that we at least have some kind of understanding. In my constituency, where I normally do this work, I'd found that there's been a gap of understanding between the police and the education department. The education department would say, the head of that area would say, not in my school, in my area. We don't want to see police frequenting this area. This is a place for learning. And the police will shy away and not necessarily go there when there's a conflict or children fighting. Now, I just want to find out, in terms of your cooperation with the Department of Education, have you ever had a joint communication or communique that says to all the schools across the country, this is what constitutes modus operandi around these areas? So that may well go a long way in terms of that. Then the environment of the investigation, it looks like the number looks fairly small. It looked like it was 2,500 around. And I don't know where how spread that is, where it's focusing. Is the volume or the pattern informs the deployment in terms of various provinces, where it's located, in the event that you don't have that one-stop center? And the the last question for me, Honorable Chair, is this diversion program. Earlier in the slide, it would say so many arrested, so many numbers, 16,000 diversion program, and quite maybe could educate us a little bit about this diversion program, what constitutes that as opposed to the other. Now, I've seen some diversion program. I don't know whether the police are the lead agency here that could, in terms of the coordination and integrations of work, could lead this kind of work. The patterns of crime by children happen frequently at this particular time of the day in this area. So sometimes you find that it's after school. There's concentrations of something at a particular time because of lack of activities in various areas. Now, I just want to find out whether you are lead, because I've seen something in Brazil at some point where this particular dealing with this and drugs, where they have this sports activities for integrated sports activities in the evening that occupy the learners for a long period of time, and that reduces the number of children in conflict with the law. Now, I don't know, maybe this is not in your scope, but you are participants and you see the frequency and you see the time in which this event happens in terms of dealing with that. So that may be linking that question with your diversion program to understand what you mean. For now, I want to pause here. Thanks.
My first question is, when you're talking vulnerable groups, is albinos not vulnerable groups, part of the vulnerable groups? You don't mention them anyway. I don't know. My next question is, since 2010-2011, you tabled three reports. I mean, three reports were tabled. The fourth one, 2013-2014, excluded such information. Can you have an explanation on that? Why did it exclude your information? My next question is on the designated child justice officer for this desk at the local police stations. What else will they be doing? I'm looking at a situation where they are not overloaded like the DFOs. Will they only be focusing on this, or what else will they be doing? Can I ask? Go on. Okay. The people who deal with children in different organizations are first security players. Are these officers first cleared before they deal with this child? That's it.
Thank you. Maybe just one question while we've got picture services as well. The question of vulnerable group, the elderly. Now, you know, I'm not even talking about the SASA payout points and the vulnerability, petty crime, things like that. But there's also a tendency of swindling elderly people out of their money, quick rich schemes and things like that. I just want to know, maybe from the detective services, is there any facts or any studies in terms of that pattern where elderly people are specifically targeted? I just want to know, is there any stats on that issue and any kind of trends? Because the elderly is especially a vulnerable group, and especially economic crime is usually used as a possible target action. So if we can just kind of get feedback on that. General Stoyer, that is the questions for the first round. Over to you, and your view.
Thanks so much, Chair. I'm going to start with the question on the operations here. I think firstly, Chair, operation here, we start with the national instruction. There's a not joint national instruction which outlines exactly the operational concept and then how should members present themselves when they conduct this particular operation. And then there's similar officers from both the South African Police Service and other entities within the criminal justice process, the entities that we are working together, like the monitoring group, that ensures that the joint instruction is implemented without any violation. Further to that, we also issue a national crime combat team instruction. The national crime combating instruction outlines the combating approach, which legislations are governing the operational process, and which legislations and other national instructions should be complied with, from extradition to arrest up to the latter. We also have a legal scrutiny, which is part and parcel of the operational process to ensure that we observe human rights, we observe any other process that could lead to a violation of human rights during the process. For all the operations, we have parades. And these parades are inspected by senior officers, and these senior officers, they also include senior government officers across the criminal justice cluster. In the recent one, there was also visited by ministers of the criminal justice system. At the end of, during the operation, we've got a live job where there's a situational report each and every hour, which is part and parcel to the monitoring. And at the end, there's debriefings and post-mortems. If there's anything that did not go right, we know immediately after that particular operation. But apart from that, we also bring other equipment that has the technology, like the videos. We video our operations, so that we make sure that incidents that are taking place, we are able to reproduce them either for court purposes or if there's any. But I also want to relate up front and say, I think Operation Viela, it's not usual business. It is not business as usual. I think it's almost first experience of many people who are getting in touch with police visibility. I think we're going to hostels, we're going to buildings that are not lawfully occupied. And those are people who be staying in those buildings for years, start searching those buildings. And obviously we unsettle them. But we haven't started to become wrong because we expect arrest in those particular buildings. We are also even starting other processes of challenging the existence of those buildings, because some of them, they no longer supposed to exist either. And we are taking those particular processes up. But then our experience also is that the most effective operations conducted from the South African Police Service side, they are always felt from the response of the community. I think this operation within the shortest space of time, when it has started, I think this is one operation where we expected the highest number of arrests. I think in 3 weeks' time we have managed to arrest 3,200. And all of them I think I in custody. Then again, we've also agreed with Home Affairs with the Lingala project. We are dealing with legal immigrants completely different. And that is also paying on the dividends of the operation. But I just want them to give their friends, as you have requested, Chair, that over and above the current measures that we have, we are also going to intensify the control over the operation. But not just to intensify the control, we will also intensify the arrest request. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Other responses?
Let me just take a few questions and then I'm going to hand over to the team to respond to the other questions. The one question I wanted to talk to is the one on the number of clusters. I just wanted to start explaining the two. To say the number that is reflected here of the FCS units are units within the clusters. The clusters, the number of clusters has been reduced, but the number of units has not been affected. So the FCS units will remain 176. But the clusters are the ones that are reducing. And in responding to the question of the clusters, we conducted the work study under the direction of the National Commissioner. But that was a National Management Forum resolution in order to enhance that particular process. So there is a work study which has been conducted. There has been consultation within and broadly. And that's where we then arrive at a decision through the work study to implement a new cluster management framework. I think it may not suffice to give all the details here because the cluster management concept, the broad framework on its own, maybe we can talk about it, but it doesn't affect the units that you see here. They'll still remain the same. And then there's the question by the Honourable Member on the national instructions versus the legislation. I think the moment we receive a new legislation, our responsibility as the South African Police Service to operationalize the legislation, which in another language you can call it implementation. Now for us to implement it, we need to simplify it to operational level so that we make sure that we reduce its understanding and interpretation to the level of the operator down there. We want a constable to understand what are the steps that must be taken in order for us to conclude that this act has been implemented. So when all such legislation comes, the leading divisions sit together with legal services, then we draft a simplified process that shows the step-by-step in terms of implementing this act and all the level of compliance. That's what we call a national instruction. But as and when we draft all these national instructions, we make sure that they are never in conflict with the legislation. And that is a process that is being monitored. And so, Honourable Chair, for each legislation, you will find national instruction within the police. Then there's a question on the sustainability of training. The training program, the implementation of the training program for members is led by HRD, which is the formal training. But the moment the members come back from the training and they get back, we then introduce refresher training at training service level, which is more on the job. And over and above the refresher, we also introduce mentorship. We revert to the mentorship strategy and we identify certain groups that we need to mentor. And we then have an ongoing in-service training that does not only affect the Epsilon but cuts across a number of them. The last question I wanted to take before I hand over to the colleagues is the relationship between health and education, the gap which might be existing. Firstly, I wanted to indicate that we have got a memorandum of understanding which has been signed between the Department of Education as well as the South African Body Service. This memorandum of understanding relates to the implementation of school safety. And through this memorandum, we got an integrated approach which is kept up in planning between us as well as the Department of Education. Firstly, where you see it featuring, we've got a community outreach. With the community outreach, and then we adopted the school outreach in all the schools, we've got that group of police who have adopted a school. In each one of the schools, you will find the head, the crime prevention head. You will all find the FES member. You will find the CPO from the police station, the social crime prevention officer, the whole, and the sector commander. The whole of those teams, they are responsible or they are dedicated to that particular school. And we also deal with SGBs. We work with school safety of officers from education. And whenever a school is a hotspot, because we do the crime analysis, whenever the school is hotspot, firstly, we agree, we inform the principal. And then we inform the SGB, then we inform the circuit. And then we explain to them what we call a surprise operational concept. When we do that surprise operational concept, they know we can enter any school at any given time, as long as we've got intelligence. And then through the MOU platforms, we sit with them and then we share. Up to this chair, we're not experiencing any issues with the Department of Education. Of course, if you're doing implementation, there will always be some few issues here and there, but we hide them up and we know how to reach each other, and then we take on with the implementation. From the youth crime prevention side, you see there will be the junior commissioner project coming, and then it was implemented at schools, and it's been working very, very, very well. We tested into provinces. It was the state and the Limpopo. It was fully implemented, and education is supporting us. So I just want to then hand over to my colleagues to continue with the other questions, and I'll come with another chapter.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. I'm going to start, but when I conclude the Gresilamela just raises that issue of the specific date on the LGBTI program and just explain that context because it is a program that's come for longer than from the 29th of April and that Vivian Nyati will give the figures of the children under 10. Okay, the first question from the Honourable Skolovan of the difficulties in terms of reporting together, this is a challenge for us too, and I don't want to hide that at all. Our current administration system captures the charges. So police count charges on that system, we don't count offenders. Whereas social development, when that assess a child, so even if there's multiple charges against the child, there'll be one assessment. So that is a challenge for the interdepartmental monitoring process as well. There's two issues I want to raise in that respect. We do get feedback from the operational committees that monitor. So if a child that we've charged was not to be assessed, that would be reported to us. The moment they go to a preliminary inquiry, they will say that this child has not been assessed. So you cannot proceed, the process will not proceed if a child has not been assessed. So if a child has been charged, they must be assessed before the process can continue. So we pick that up on an operational basis. But the challenge remains in terms of the reporting the figures. What we've asked of the Lithium is to look at whether we can, from the system side, report both the charges and the number of children, so that we can say we've had so many charges but involve so many children. And they're busy working with us on that, but when we implement a new reporting system like that, or when we try and exact new information, we need to verify the reliability of that data first before we start reporting it as government information. So that is what TM is assisting us with at the moment. Also with the implementation of the ICDMS, which is the next evolution of CAS, we're trying to build some of these challenges that we've had with CAS into that development. It's part of the broader IJS development process. Because we have picked this up in a number of programs that we're monitoring, that the way in which we generate information from our operational systems doesn't talk adequately to the way other departments monitor and implement systems. So at the moment, we don't have the information of the number of children, but what we do have with the charges is we report on charges per age group, so from age 10 upwards for every age, 13, 11, 12, we report the charges to justice per age. And per police station, per province, we did not bring that into the presentation because it's obviously a fairly thick document, but we can certainly provide a detailed copy. We have in the past, I think, provided to the committee that detailed report on the charges against children broken down per age and per province and per station. With the children under 10, currently the police are not yet passing that on a system, but we must defer every child. I do just want to also emphasize the child under 10, because we can't charge them and because that is not information that we're hiding, and I think this is well known, we're trying to get people to be aware of the requirements of the Act and that children under 10 do not have criminal capacity. So it's possible that a child under 10 who has committed a crime may not be reported to the police. And in sure, for instance, they might refer that matter directly to a probation officer. So it is possible not all children under 10 coming into contact with the law would be reported to the police. But when they are reported to the police, this is where we've implemented the enhancement to the offence system from this year onwards, this current financial year onwards. We've instructed that the stations must, for every child under 10 that they are become aware of, they cannot charge a child, but they must capture the referral information on the OPAM system so that we can draw a report, and this will now be the child. So at least this will be different than that counts charges. We would then be able to compare with social development where all the children that were reported to us under 10 have been assessed by them. Figuring not you all, when I conclude the figures that have been published by social development in terms of the number of children under 10 that they've assessed. And then in terms of how many children are being diverted before preliminary inquiry, the information I have in the presentation in terms of diversion is the figure of children diverted as part of the preliminary inquiry process. The cases are not diverted before the preliminary inquiry. It's a decision taken at the preliminary inquiry that the case will be diverted. But then there's also in the annual reports of the Child Justice Act, we also report on children who are sentenced to correctional services. And there's a breakdown of all the other alternative sentences. So diversion would refer to a case that has not gone to trial and was diverted before it went to trial. In terms of sentences, so the case that did go to trial, we do also have cases that are concluded for each of community-based sentences, restorative justice sentences, correctional supervision. So there's alternative sentencing. Not every child that's sentenced would go to a custodial sentence. Are there more fewer children coming into conflict with the law? In terms of our statistics, and unfortunately this is one of the challenges that we capture children who we charge. So in terms of that, there has been a drop in the number of children that we've charged, but the figures for the current financial year, that they haven't been audited yet, they haven't reported them yet, but that does indicate that stabilizing is going up again. But yes, there seems to have been, since the Act came into, doesn't mean that there are fewer children coming into conflict with the law, but there are fewer children being charged for offences in terms of statistics of the police. But when you look at the statistics of the other department, there's also been changes, and that's why we gave the slide that compares the statistics of such justice and social development. So one can also see whether the charges that dropped relate to also a difference in terms of children assessed and children directed. The question in terms of what is a contact point? A contact point is not to put, okay, let me start by saying a fully fledged police station is a police station that functions 24 hours and basically renders a full scope of services of the police. A satellite police station is usually linked to a fully fledged police station. It usually renders a 24-hour service, but it may not have its own detective, so it wouldn't render all the services. But a satellite police station often must function 24/7. But a contact point would be a community by first point where it's into an existing police station. It's not a fully fledged or autonomous police station. It usually does not function 24/7. So you have an arrangement, for instance, that we will open this contact point from 8 o'clock to 5 o'clock with service provided to the community at that physical building, but the service to the community outside is provided by the mother, the police station in the area. So when we talk about a contact point in the terms of the statistics I've provided here for the victim service rooms, that means there's one contact point in the country that has its own victim service room. That does not mean it's the only contact point in the country. We maintain a number of contact points. Sometimes that's linked to sector policing, where you have a contact point during certain times of the day, where you physically have police present, people can come certified documents, sport card, and other times it's released by a mobile police, by sector police in the vehicles and so on. In terms of the... Yes, sir?
That's it. Let us also to add on the contact point. It's important for us to mention that contact points are linked to sector policing. Whenever we realize that a sector is a hotspot, then we are likely to put a contact point there. But then a satellite is likely to service more than one sector because it's at a higher level than a contact point. But the one of the other reasons why we might not have been having one contact point with this particular facility, it might be more than one. But from time to time, certain of our contact points, they graduate to satellites as a result of your growing profiles. And certain of our satellites, they're also graduating to police stations, and that will minimize the numbers. Thank you.
The next question speaks to the police role responsibilities in LGBTI task team and rapid response task team. Essentially, they're the generic functions of the police, yes, are the same functions. We would register a crime and take the statement. We would investigate the crime. We would ensure that the case goes to court. We would further victim fall support. So it speaks to how we would undertake their functions and how we could specifically be more sensitive to the needs of this community. So the specific roles of police in terms of the target and the rapid response teams would be based on the general responsibilities of the police, but would be speaking to what are the specific or additional or articulate needs of the LGBTI community, because I think as the honourable member mentioned, he's been part of some of those services. We've been working as the department really closely with a number of organisations in this environment, and they've articulated specific needs and aspects that they needed us to address. So for instance, with the rapid response teams, one of the issues is where an advocacy group becomes aware of a case or a specific concern, they would inform us and we would be able to intervene. But we would intervene in terms of our normal responsibilities. So there's not a separate set of police responsibilities, but it speaks to how we address that and how specifically we address the need of that community. Only one-stop centres, when it's not a one-stop centres, what happens in the victim support centres and what is our footprint in the country. The one-stop centres, as I've mentioned two examples of one-stop centres, and I just want to say that this is actually quite a difficult question to answer, not because I don't know the answer, but because it's such a long answer. Because there's a myriad of different examples of one-stop centres. Some of them are really localised, where you have a local initiative that sets up a one-stop centre that's not necessarily part of the Juvela Care Centre or part of the Kusuleka model of social development. A lot of these centres are local initiatives based on the service providers in a certain area. It could be a faith-based organisation or it could be a business that sponsors an initiative. So it's difficult to speak to one model. There are different models of one-stop centre in place. But when a one-stop centre essentially brings different services under one roof, so what makes it one-stop is that you go to one place and you get all the services. Now, whether it's a Juvela Care Centre, often they're based at a hospital, but then you would have someone at that physical facility that deals with counselling, for instance, so you don't have to refer someone off-site for counselling, they can receive counselling on the site. We usually have an arrangement where police come to the centre, so if a victim reports to the police station, we will take them to the TCC. If the victim reports at the TCC, we will send the police there to take their statement. So essentially, they don't all work exactly the same way, because it also is in different areas, and one builds the model based on the capacity in that area and the service providers in that area. But essentially, what happens when there isn't a service that provides everything under one roof is that each of the departments will then provide their service, each of the stakeholders will then provide their service. So if there isn't a one-stop centre in a victim support room at a police station, police will deal with policing responsibilities. So we would inform the victim of their rights as part of our police responsibilities. We would take the statement there, we would do the referral there, and we would, depending on the nature of the victim's needs, we might take the victim to the hospital for the forensic medical exam, and they might then be referred, we might make appointments with them for counselling. If there's a victim-friendly volunteer group at a police station, some of what police would be, their responsibilities would be enhanced by that victim support group. So where police would, for instance, take the statement, we would still do all our basic responsibilities, but you might have a volunteer physically going with victim, you might have a volunteer calling them to follow up on their case, you might have that volunteer making, calling their family, asking someone to bring them clean clothes, whatever the case might be. So the volunteer enhances the services provided by police, and often they're based at a victim-friendly room, and they might also, in terms of enhancing the service to the victim, they might, in the victim's language, with the support of the police, then provide the explanation of the rights and speak to them about. They do the practical things of the rights, the responsibilities, and give feedback on the case. So all of that can happen in the victim support room at the police station, but we would still refer usually for counselling to organisations that do the counselling. But there are instances where we have an arrangement with an organisation that does counselling on these premises. It's done as a separate service not provided by the police, but they use our victim support rooms to do the counselling, so people can come to the police and get counselling there. So that doesn't happen in all victim support rooms. Some of the provinces, and again I apologise, Mr. Chair, for the long answer. This is quite a comprehensive, it's different in many different places. In some of the provinces, with the assistance of the community safety departments, there are victim support programs where community safety and police work together, and they, for instance, from community safety side, mobilise volunteers, train them, and ensure that there's a service, a more comprehensive service unit and a police station. I know that in Western Cape, some of the stations that is happening, and I know that happens in Gauteng as well. Then, in terms of the question on specialisation of obtaining, Sitoli did answer that question. I just want to ask to say that we have an ongoing need to make sure that we have trained people on the ships. People will get promoted, they'll move into different environments, they might become a detective. So as people move, we will on an ongoing basis identify that there's a need to train people. But we would want on every shift, specifically for child arrest, as a member to deal with children, might not be physically at the police station. We want on every shift as members work to have a knowledgeable person. So that's eventually we would want every operational person that would come, that could possibly come in contact with a child in contact with the law to be trained. So this is still for us an ongoing need, and I don't think there will ever not be a need. There might be slightly less a need, but for the time being, certainly we haven't trained all our operational members. Also, we do get new recruits, and we do get new people coming into this environment. For the moment still, we are going to continue with the in-service training so that we have adequate capacity in every police station, both working outside but also working in the police station. But what we don't have is dedicated child justice officers. I think there was a question in that regard. I created a misconception in that respect. We have an instruction that we ask every police station to ensure that on every shift they have members that is defined, but they're not dedicated members. They're all the members of the ship. It could be a lead commander or it could be a member on the ship, but we just basically want to make sure that the members who are trained are spread evenly and everybody has access to that information. But we don't have dedicated child justice officers at the moment. Then the issue of whether we need a better understanding of what kind of children are in conflict or what kind of offences children are dealing with, and a better understanding of the offences that children commit, yes, that is not something that we've worked on at the moment yet. We haven't done an analysis or the profile of the children, but it's something that both in police with our crime analysis research office, but also possibly as part of the broader ISCCJ, we can look at, you know, who are the children, are there specific patterns or things that we can identify, so that we can also deal with prevention better. Just in addition also in terms of the MOU between SAC and education, we don't have joint communication other than the MOU that's been provided to all the departments that specifies what we want to see both departments do. But what we do have is we've worked with education to develop school-based crime prevention guidelines. So we work together and say these are our guidelines for police that are informed by what is in the protocol and our engagement with education. And that guidelines to the police, for instance, takes into account education-specific policies like their policy for dealing with drugs in schools. From education side, again, that's taken note of what the protocol requires. They've engaged with us and their instructions to the education environment is then also informed by their engagement with police in terms of what is expected from the schools and the schools officers in terms of working with police. the issue of what diversion entails, first of all, Honourable Member, the police is not the lead agency. So we would not, I wouldn't be able to give a lot of detail in terms of what diversion entails, but what I can say is that diversion programs are registered by the Department of Social Development. They do the quality control of the programs. And usually that can include different aspects. That can deal with managing conflicts and violence. They can deal with family group conferencing and working with families and children. They can include treatment for substance addictions. So there's a variety of different aspects of diversion programs that tailored to the specific child's needs. So a child that has a substance abuse problem, the diversion program would normally include some form of treatment for that substance abuse problem. Then the work in terms of registering diversion programs is led by social development. And again, the question you raised in terms of can we identify specific factors, I think that in terms of working with all the different departments, that is something that the committee can certainly look at, where we can identify patterns. We have some examples where police have initiated the touch program. So for instance, in Mitchell's Plain here in Cape Town, they have worked very closely with community organizations, CBFs, and identified police officers that work specifically with children. And they would, for instance, as they do their patrols, identify places where children converge, times when children converge, and then engage those children and try to get them into, for instance, coaching programs for football. They've got the build program at the schools, the door peloton. So there's some examples where police might pick up that there's a particular, as we analyze our crime, we would pick up certain patterns and then we would engage with our stakeholders in that community to try and raise them. But from a national perspective, in terms of our national programs, we have not undertaken that on a holistic national level. The first question asked by Honourable Mulumbasa, I couldn't hear what was included in vulnerable. The question about what would be included in vulnerable, ma'am.
If albinos are part of the vulnerable.
In terms of the what we define as yes, definitely are included both as, but they would be included both as a child with albinism would be a particularly vulnerable child, and both in terms of disabilities, because there might be disabilities in terms of eyesight and specifically vulnerabilities of albinist group. And so yes, they are identified as a specific vulnerable group. The designated, we don't answer on the designated child justice officers. Are people dealing with children security clear? Are police officers, all the police, we don't have dedicated people dealing with the child justice, as I mentioned, but all police officers are, we have to be clear, in terms of the criminal, you can't have a criminal record and be a police member. So all police officers are clear in that respect. And obviously, police officers deal specifically with children, like adopt cops. They are vetted specifically in that regard as well. Then there were questions in terms of the details, but if I might just ask Brigadier Silumela to offer on the date issue, and Brigadier Minati to give the additional numbers in terms of the children under 10. And then in terms of three report tables, the fourth excluded this information. I think that there was an interim report that excluded this information, but that information was added in the report, the final report that was tabled in Parliament, the 2013-14 report. The final report did include this information. But I will verify that and just verify that and give that answer before we leave. That's all good.
The responses?
Thanks, Honourable Chair. With regard to the number of children under the age of 10 who have been assessed by probation officers and social workers, we have 254 in the previous financial year. Chair, you had also asked the question regarding the elderly and availability of statistics in that regard. Yes, that information can be made available, and we've requested that if we could be provided with that information regularly, we'll see from that. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. I'm going to deal with the detective-related questions. There was a question about the few numbers of detectives dealing with the Act. The presentation deals with children in conflict with the law relating to the sexual offences. So that is FCS figures that are provided. But other children that are in conflict with the law in terms of the Act are being dealt with at police station level. So there's, it's not the only number of members, police members, that are dealing with children in conflict with the law. So that's just the one issue. The second issue relates to your question, Honorable Chair, about the swindling of money from the elderly. What we've experienced is in the past where there were pay pens, that the elderly would borrow money from money lenders or loan sharks, and excessive interest would ask, for example, 1 rand on rand. If you borrow 1 rand, you will have to repay 1 rand. Or they would provide the elderly with food, meat, and that type of thing, and they will excessively charge them. They will take their identity documents, and only on the day of the payout, they would provide the pensioner or the elderly person with the documents. He or she will go and draw the money, and they will take all the money and borrow again on that specific day. So it was easy for us to please that, to arrest and charge these loan sharks. But because the mere fact that they borrow money is not a crime. The crime that we charge them on is in terms of the Reserve Bank Act, the excessive charging of interest. So we had successes in that regard. But the challenge that we now have is that the elderly are issued with the SASSA cards. So they go to Pick and Pay and Checkers, and the loan shark is following them. Or the loan shark takes them to Pick and Pay and Checkers, and they draw money. And the loan shark then takes the money and borrow them money. And so it's a bit difficult now with the card for us to police. But there is still places where there is pay points that we have constantly under observation. The other challenge that I specifically noticed, and that is a concern for me, is that on these days where such a payment are being made, bus loads and taxi loads of elderly people are being taken to casinos where they spend their money, and I'm not sure whether this taking to the casino is an organized thing, and who is organizing it. But I've observed that you see bus loads of, and taxi loads of elderly people entering the casino premises as you pass the casinos. Now, I'm not sure whether they go and play or whether they go and watch movies and so on, but I think it is just an exploitation of the elderly to go and play on the slot machines and lose their money. I think maybe as the police, we should engage the other role players relating to that challenge of the elderly going to the casinos on the days when such a payment is made to them. Chair, and then on, we don't specifically have information relating to swindling of elderly. What I can report on is that I report on a quarterly basis to the JCPS DEFCOM meeting, Development Committee meeting, relating to crimes committed against the elderly in terms of the Older Persons Act. I don't have the figures with me now, but what I can say is that there is a decline in crimes. I'm talking about crimes in general being committed against the elderly. What is of interest is that most of these crimes that are committed against older persons are committed by relatives and people near to them, stealing their money to go and buy drugs, assaulting them because they don't want to give money. That's the challenge that I've noticed when I analyze crimes against the elderly. Thank you, Jim.
accept all the responses, or one outstanding one?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I would like to respond on the question of why it took so long to launch the LGBTI program. I would like to apologize for the date that appears on the presentation. The correct date is 29 April 2014, and the leading department is the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. Thank you.
Right, Honorable Members, we'll take a 7-minute tea break, and we'll come back for the second round and follow-ups. 7.5 minutes. Tea break.
I'm going to go to the hospital. honorable member has done. So I'm very proud of the contract with the government again. Hey, what's the number of the government? Hey, what's the target? What's the government? The government must be 200 billion to be recorded. And then, it's the target.
3 minutes. understand, but thank you very much. I know you, you know, I do work with him.
Thank you very much, honorable members and delegation. Thank you for attending to the short tea break. Welcome back. We will go now to the second round and also follow up some of the members wanted to ask. Let's start off from the side with honorable Mulabachi.
Yeah, Chairperson. I'm very, very worried about the explanation of the General Bernard about the... When people in the NGOs, before they even set their foot on that facility, they must be security cleared. Now, with subs, the people who are working with the children are not security cleared. I'm very, very worried, just the person. But it means even somebody who was convicted or arrested at some point for rape will still be working with children. My second question is, I'm even lost. When we visit the police stations, we find that they are, some police stations don't have juvenile cells. As a result, they put these young people in cells with older people. What should be done according to the act in that regard? And then I'll come back
then.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question is one. What happens in an event a particular police station does not have a victim-friendly room and a need arises? Thank you.
Honorable Member, Honorable Ramasakane, are you covered? Honorable Marke, Honorable Mabija, I'll give it to Honorable Twala. Are you?
Thank you. There's some relevant left. I think the police and their press will kind of up their game in relation to the challenge. The mention has been made of employment of social workers, forensic social workers, or 75 of them, have they been increased, and what has been the impact? The other issue would be around the, you know, policemen are by nature crime fighters. in terms of culture change in relation to these crimes? Has there been a significant change in attitude, the ability of the police to address such petty offences? Are they able to deal with them in terms of the training that you provide them with? Do you see results in terms of ability to handle such places, minor children, you know, in the stage of development and all else? Yeah, I would pause there, second.
Thanks, Chairperson, and thank you for the comprehensive responses on my previous questions. All of them were covered. My next question is just in terms of the point about staff members being capacitated on how to handle LGBTI persons when they present to report hate crimes. I'm just curious because, you know, the second victimization, it was mentioned verbally in the presentation, although it's not reflected in the text, is a big concern for many LGBTI people, where when somebody has, you know, been assaulted, raped, or has some other violation on the basis of homophobic prejudice, to come to a police station, especially if they, for example, an effeminate gay man, and to have the person at the community service center kind of laugh a joke and call their colleagues in the back room and say, "Ooh, what's the one that is chosen?" You know, it's really quite injurious to their dignity having suffered that violation. So this kind of intervention and awareness raising and education is crucial. So I'm curious on two questions: is do you have any figures or an estimate of how many officers have gone through this kind of sensitization training and the provincial spread, if you have this? And more crucially, who does that training? Who are the service providers? Because I'm aware of a handful at least of LGBT organizations having approached the service with the offer to run these seminars, especially where there are problematic hotspots that crop up and are reported to them. Just what's the picture and the status quo in terms of that training? Thank you.
Thanks. Can you give me an indication, before the lady shut the SPS unit, how many were there, and how what staff were assigned to them in numbers in relation to what we've got today? Do we have more? That would be good news. Numbers of staff, a highly trained staff, because it's really the most, they've got to be the worst units to work in, dealing with rape babies and things. I mean, they're very, very difficult, highly trained, skilled people. So I'd like to have that. And look, I know it's difficult with the figures, and are going to send us that substantial report, which may include some of the figures I'm asking for now, so we can just wait till we get the report, yes? I'm wanting to know if there are more or fewer children who come into contact with the law going to trial and being sentenced to imprisonment than previously, and are there more or fewer children in prison serving their sentences than there were, and why has there been a nearly 16% drop in preliminary inquiries and a nearly 9% decrease in assessments? Are we looking at, because the figures seem to show an increase in criminality, but the assessments and the preliminary inquiries seem to be dropping. An answer there, please. Now, the number of children detained awaiting trial is increasing, not decreasing, while the numbers of children held in child and youth centres is dropping again. Need an explanation there. There seems to be an enormous number of children arrested and then acquitted. Huge numbers. We're talking about over 13,000 arrested, but only 2,750 found to be guilty. So the rest are just released. Now, what does that speak to? Either people are arresting children, just scooping them up without committing any crime, or with no evidence, or with no witnesses, or what, or chats are really bad in court. Do we have any indication of what the recidivism rates are in terms of children? How many are in remand detention or serving sentences in correctional services? And finally, the number of children really being admitted to correctional services. Again, are we increasing or decreasing
has this bill done, I think, what we're looking for, what it was meant to do? Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable Ramatakane, Honourable Malabachi.
Now, Honourable Chair, the on page 16, I just wanted to find out when they're talking about the guidelines that have been finalized in dealing with the people with disabilities. What do you actually mean by that? When do we want to see complete guidelines completed? Why is it taking this bit of time to finalize? Because we're talking about something that is been around for some time. The last comment that I just want to make here is that there is this whole thing about before celebrity shadow is before celebrity death. I just want to say that as I understand from where I'm sitting, in fact, the issue that debate about shutting off of the family and child unit has always been a myth. It's never happened. I take practical experience of it. When everybody was calling that the shut off, actually it wasn't. It was there, it was functioning. In fact, it was actually being rolled out. And I just want to make that statement, because that statement of fact. There are some statements that are not factual. This one is fact because I know I was right involved in this kind of work. But the one thing I just want to caution here, and I did raise an objection with the honourable member on Friday in the debate. Jetty's Lever is late National Commissioner of Police. The footballing of playing the name of Jetty Selewe as a football is insensitive. It borders on serious, I think, insult in my culture. Serious insult.
Point of order.
That.
Point of order, Chair. I'm sorry. I'm asking for your protection. Selewe was arrested and jailed for these crimes, for shutting down units, for dealing with drug people. That is why he was jailed. He was a criminal who brought the greatest insult to the stats we have ever had. To have someone sit there saying, I may not say his name in this committee, I'm sorry, I have to. He shut them down. I'm asking what has happened subsequently. I won't be insulted like this. Don't lay the traditional thingy card with me.
Thank you, Honourable Labas. No,
maybe just for this one.
No, I don't know whether I don't finish my point. What are you doing with me out of order, Chair?
Jetty's Lever was not arrested for shutting down units. He was not arrested for that.
He
shut them down. Stop. He shut them down. No. And we all know why.
Order.
I will first make the ruling, please, I'll see that hands, please. Honourable members, we are dealing with this presentation and questions. Let us go back to the core business that is we are dealing with here this morning. Let's stop the name calling and other issues. Let us continue with the business. I think we took note of the point raised by Honourable Ramatakane. Let us continue. Thank you. You're welcome to continue, Honourable Ramatakane.
Chair, with respect, I wanted to say that facts speaks. Yeah, we're talking about shutting down of this particular unit, which is in fact being economical with the truth, because as this communication was happening as a political fun part, I was in the Western Cape. This went in the whole hour of shut down. So where was this happening? It's a fiction of imagination. It was taking place.
Chairperson, I'm happy to fill him in with the reality of the situation after the meeting. I'll forward all the statements, all the information to him directly.
Chairperson, no, I'm not speaking.
furnish that information, but let's continue with the meeting on the core business. Let's do that. Okay. Honourable Mumula.
Thank you, Chairperson. But Chairperson, let's respect each other. Why the member is talking, the other member is talking again. Let's respect each other, please.
Right, Honourable Members, let's continue. Honourable Robert Carney, you want to continue?
I would not continue because constantly the Honourable Cora Barnard interjects because she doesn't hear what I want to say. So perhaps in respect to your ruling, I shouldn't proceed because I wanted to unmask this fictitious imagination. I want to unmask it once and for all so that you know what's the truth. So, but I leave it that with your ruling. I respect that ruling, but we will come back to this issue again.
Right, Honourable Malabashi, then Honourable Marke.
Thank you, Sir President. Yeah, my question is, does where do we put in the witches? Are they not part of the so-called witches? Are they not part of the vulnerable groups? Thanks, Sir.
Marky, thank you, Honourable Marabachi.
Thank you, Sir President. I think Chairperson must protect us. We are not going to allow one member here to do as she wishes. She's actually undermining the authority as Chairperson here. And maybe we need to protect you. That is totally unacceptable. Because we are not doing that. It's as if we are foolish if we don't interject. And that is totally unacceptable. And if I was to, it's not in our culture to talk that way about a person who has died. You can't go to a funeral and say, this person who has died was a criminal. You can't do that. And you can't just rubbish our culture as we are sitting here. It's totally unacceptable. And oh, my question was on the processes when children are arrested. I'm just thinking about a police station in the far rural areas where there are no facilities and so on. The processes, according to me, seem very complicated. And if I was a police person, I would end up just slapping the kid on the wrist and say, go home and never do that again. Because if I'm to follow this, I don't have a social worker there. I don't have a stowed school or whatever they call it. I don't have anything that I can do in the process. The only place I have is to lock the kid in a cell, which is against the law. So I see it, maybe that's why it is going down. It means maybe the law is a bit complicated to deal with. And do you have any suggestion on how you can solve such a problem? Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay, Honourable Mabuja.
Chairperson, I'm worried. Ramakasano was speaking, even though you made the ruling, are we going to contribute according to how another honourable member feels about the issue? Because now, Ramakasano is now like an Egyptian mummy. He's quiet. He's not unmasking what he wanted to unmask just because another honourable member is interjecting. So what's the reason of sitting here being barred from speaking out one's mind? I don't really understand that. Thank you.
We can deal with the issue. The first, the principal issue is freedom of speech is the basis of interaction in a politics environment. Now, the only way we can put restrictions on that if it's really
if it's libelous or if it's really of a certain nature that we can't allow in the parliamentary environment. The issue raised by Honourable Abkhani is quite adamant, and of course he's indicating while it was MEC, the Western Cape, there wasn't any let's say more moratorium on the rollout of the GS units. Now that is contested by Honourable Rola Barnard. Now that's a factual dispute. Now we can debate it for a very long time. We are going to get a solution today. That's why I said let's continue with the current interaction. We'll take another opportunity where those information can be put before the committee, and then we can look at facts. But it's not going to help us, because the one member is going to say the FCS units were stopped, the other one is going to. So it's a factual dispute. We're not going to solve it here today. So my view is let us continue with the current interaction. We can follow that up in the next meeting. It's not good. Yes.
We must stop interjections. We must make a stop interjecting when other people are talking.
So once again, I think the principle is members must respect all members. If there is an issue you don't agree with, wait for that other member to complete the sentence and court process, and then through the chair raise the issue. Let's be civil. Honourable Bailey.
Thanks, Chair. It's just a question for the Deputy National Commissioner that was triggered by the points of the vulnerability of elderly people in relation to their pension being stolen for drug money, which is a very big concern. Has the National Minister given any instruction, especially in the recent states of gang-related activity that you've seen in the media? Has the National Minister given any instruction, however many sort of provisions and caveats have been attached to it, on the re-establishment of specialized anti-gang and anti-drug units? And if so, what are the timelines and what are the geographical stipulations around that? Because there's been unconfirmed rumors, if you will, but anything solid hasn't quite been forthcoming. And just as a parting shot, it's always useful to remember that there's a difference between something being culturally taboo to something being unparliamentary. This forum, I think, fully concerned itself with what is unparliamentary, and many of the members on this committee will know that when I relate to them interpersonally, I observe cultural conventions, dumela me, dumela ntate. But have no fear, when we debate in the House, I will tumble as much as I need to. So let's just be aware of the distinctions around context and how what is acceptable or not.
Thank you very much. Let's go to the delegation, General Sitola and your team, for responses.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I will again respond to certain of the questions, and the team is going to respond to others. I would just also like to make a request here, because whenever police come to interact with parliamentarians, we emphasize on discipline. We tell them we respect the parliamentarians and we respect the portfolio committee. Now, all I'm requesting is, if I come here, the national commissioner is called Ria. None of us can ever. It will be very difficult for us to answer the questions, because the police protocol dictates that we should either address her as general or national commissioner. So that's just what I'm requesting, because even if I'm called by name here, these others will find it very difficult to respond to such a question. But that's what we just do, so that it doesn't become very difficult. Yeah, for us to respond. Because if you can hear any one of them calling a parliamentarian by name, we're going to default. Yeah, so if that's what we're going to make easy for responding, because it might be very difficult for me to say get this, I would say, either for management or so general. Thank you. Thank you. Chair, I want to respond on the question of the security clearance. I wanted to make space to the honorable member for three levels of security clearance. The first one, we start with the GAC analysis. The National Commissioner issued an instruction that all members of the South African Police Service, all 195,000, must go to GAC analysis, which is the easiest part. So, with the GAC analysis, none of the members who have got a record can be missed out. It captures the criminal and departmental conditions and even lifestyle audits, if there were lifestyle audits. So that is the third level. Then you have the second level of security, that is clearance, which is deals with secret. And that one we link it to a CI analysis. And at times it also escalated then to FSA. Then we've got top secret, which is the other level. Just to make sure that we deal with the foundation part, all of them are going to get analysis. Those that are handling this aspect at the current moment, they've gone through get analysis. And we will still escalate it to another level of the security clearance. It should just be to make contact on that part. The second question was on the juvenile cells. Those police stations which do not have juvenile cells. I first want to say that since the inception of this act, we have issued a cut and dry instruction to all members. Juveniles can't be detained without that. So that is an instruction. And it is seriously and strongly monitored. In the case of a police station that doesn't have a juvenile detention, we look at a nearby area where we can deal with that. But it's more complex, like this other question which was raised by the honorable member in rural areas, whatever. We also look at other alternatives that from investigation. They also check whether the parents can be, there can be an arrangement for custody for duration of the investigation or whatever. But we don't allow them to detain children with adults anymore. Then there was a question of the need for a friendly, a victim-friendly room. The first alternative that we opt for when we do not have a victim-friendly room at a police station is a nearest hospital or a health facility that can work with us. So some of our police stations are linked there. But then, obviously, the second option, we establish the victim-friendly rooms. That is ourselves. But we just make sure that at that particular police station, there's a victim-friendly service rendered. Yes, and we link with any other help. Then, I think the honorable member on the forensic social workers, we thank you for that, because I just wanted to confirm that we do have forensic social workers who have employed and they are deployed. But I think the general Muslim is going to talk more on the impact. I want to say upfront, it's very hard, up to this bar. But you will talk a little bit more. Then there was a question on the change of attitudes by members who are handling this particular issue. I think I wanted to start by saying, firstly, the change of mindset of members to deal with this matter is aligned with the National Crime Prevention Strategy, because the National Crime Prevention Strategy has introduced a totally new approach to crime prevention and also in dealing with crime at the level of the police station. So we started orientating them in terms of the insight into the national crime prevention strategy. And then secondly, I think the national coordinator now never speaks. She does insult before she addresses the committee on the professionalization of such. And that particular program is cascaded to the last member at the station, and we are actually targeting those who are interacting with the communities, including those that are dealing with children, in terms of professionalization. We train them, we mentor them, we take them by head, we monitor them, but apart from monitoring, we also make sure that there's a bit of control management in dealing with some of these other issues. The research still drives the transformation program. And within transformation, we still have those particular programs that are targeting mainly your change of mindset as well as your paradigm change. And the last one is on modus operandi analysis. I think modus operandi analysis continuously tell us this is not the type of a cop that you need to respond to this particular type of crimes that are taking place. Hence, you need to change your approach. We also change our training to that so that we train them differently. Then, Chair, there was a question on hate crimes, whether do we have specific training which we have implemented in order to professionalize our members in this environment. But yeah, I need to answer it honestly. We main focusing on human rights training at the present moment, and as well as victim friendly. But we are working on with our training and development to continue with the research in terms of finding a new curriculum that we could shape to focus specifically on this one. We also want to appreciate the input. Then the last question that I'm going to be taking just before giving our team the opportunity is the one on the gangs. Yeah, firstly, I just want to start by saying the instruction that came from the minister was regarding the development of a gang combating and prevention strategy. And their particular process is in place and is spearheaded by NECOG. We had one of the sessions that was scheduled last week in order to finalize it. For us to talk to units, what type of units should be there, where they should be, the strategy must first be in place. But at the present moment, we are policing gangs in terms of the current policing strategy, which is in place. The moment the gang combat and prevention strategy is in place, then we'll start a dedicated approach also to gangs. Thank you, sir. I want to hand over to Chairman Johnson.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, relating to gangs, we are also engaging. In actual fact, the Secretariat has been tasked to come up with the gangsterism strategy. But what from an investigative perspective and in order to deal with gangsterism, in the provinces that we have a problem with this phenomenon is Western Cape, the peninsula mainly, Eastern Cape, Port Elizabeth, northern areas mainly, Free State, Welkom, Botshabelo, Mangaung area, in KwaZulu-Natal, the Wentworth area, and that type of thing. We have established in these provinces investigative task teams that are specifically targeting the gangsters. And in Western Cape and Eastern Cape, I can say that from an investigative perspective, we are making inroads, and we are
sending these gangsters to prison. I just want to mention that we've got a case that is coming on in the Western Cape for 5 years with Mr. Gavelt, his nickname. He has been convicted on 7 murders and 12 other charges. The Senate sentencing process is going on. In the Eastern Cape, we have major successes. KwaZulu-Natal, we recently started because the string of gangsterism flared up recently in the areas relating to drugs. In the Free State, it's mainly between young people who compete against each other relating to who's the best dresses or the most beautiful girlfriend and car and that type of thing, and then it escalates to crime. So we are addressing that, but it's not as prevalent as in Eastern Cape and Western Cape. We are, and we have resourced these task teams, and we are monitoring the successes and how they deal with gangsters. So we don't have units, but we have task teams that are dealing with the investigative process, and we are not dealing with only detectives. It's multidisciplinary. But we need interventions from other role players. We co-opt and we deal with the interventions. We also do covert investigations relating to gangsterism, which I'm not going to discuss with your permission, Chairperson. Chairperson, then, relating to the witches, yes, they are part of a vulnerable group. And we are addressing it in so much so that in my office I've got a section relating to harmful occult related crimes. And in provinces we have trained individuals that will and must assist investigating officers with how to deal with crimes relating to occult. I just want to mention specifically in the House that we are not addressing the occult. We are not addressing witchcraft per se. We are not addressing paganism per se, because it's not a crime. We are addressing the crimes that emanate from the practices relating to these matters. So I just want to make it clear, because there's a perception that we have established units to deal with the occult and paganism and witchcraft. We don't have units. We have trained individuals in the provinces that deal with the investigation of these matters. Today I've got a member from my office that has been invited to the University of Limpopo because there's matters of Satanism that the authorities of the university is concerned about. They went and they are busy there. We've also on Monday established that there were illegal circumcision schools identified three in Mpumalanga that we are also going to start addressing with the province from today. So there are members that went there. So that is the issues that we deal with relating to the occult and religious practices and that type of thing. And we have trained individuals in that regard. So thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to talk on the issue about the forensic social workers and the number of units before the re-establishment of the FCS. Thus far in the country, we have 85 forensic social workers. We have even a brigade in my office who is even providing monitoring on the ground to check as to whether the social workers are doing or are complying. Last year we had less than 85. It was 75. Now we have a total of 85. These social workers, their role is to assess children who are victims of these crimes. It's also to provide expert testimony in court and also to compile a quality report for court. And thus far, the impact, we are seeing an impact of these forensic social workers, because now there's a quick report in terms of assessment of children and submission of this report. They also contributed to the number of licenses that are on the index thus far. That's how we are utilizing the forensic social workers. And before the re-establishment of the SPL, that is when the SPLs were migrated to the police stations, we used to have 66 units around the country, and that's why we have 176. With the total number of investigating officers of 1,100, thus far we have 2,242. Thank you, Chairperson.
I cannot be not going to take that question to just respond to the few. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. The question on the what happens if a station does not have a victim friend room, the general has answered it. I just want to add that we also make specific provision for police members to identify part of a station or so local specific a room in a police station. So I could say that, for instance, the detectives that work with that area can identify one of their officers. So should there be a need to take a statement in privacy, they can ask whoever's in the office to leave and use that office. Or if there's a conference room or something like that, they can designate that and say, in this station, where you need to provide a private space for interviewing a victim, we will use that group. So that we make provisions for that in our station orders. The change in attitude, I just want to add to what the general said. In our engagement with the police stations over the last 4 years, I can't give a scientific answer, but just my own observation when I engage with police members at police stations to deal with children, I have certainly picked up that there's a greater extent of awareness of what is required of them when they deal with children. But generally, when I go to the stations, even before I ask, I would see there's a sign up at the cells that usually with the detention management saying, these are the rules that apply to detention of children. These are the contact numbers for the probation office. This is the Classic Child and Youth Care Center. So there seems to be an awareness that police must detain a child as a last resort with very specific conditions, and that they know who to work with in terms of the detention of children and what the provision are. So there seems to be a high level of awareness. But in the question that was asked in terms of what happens if there is not a specific cell available, what must happen as in a rural police station that may not have the network of support in place that other stations have? First of all, let me just start by saying we would detain not every child that is charged would be detained, and that the Act and the National Instructions give very specific guidance on that. It seems complicated because it's detailed, but actually it's fairly simple. It's just large for all the different eventualities. So they would take into account whether the child has parents that is able to take care of that child, so you could release into the care of parents, or whether there's another responsible adult that can take responsibility for the child. They would take into account the nature of the crime, the seriousness of the crime, is the child a repeat offender, is there a substance abuse problem. So basically taking those factors into account, the police would determine whether they need to detain the child, even before they go to the preliminary inquiry. So there's a call made there where there's very specific provisions in our training program and in our national instruction that police have to consider. So the vast majority of children will not be detained by the police. As soon as we've done the administration in terms of their case, we would release them to the care of a parent or the care of a responsible adult. And if we detain, it only be until such time as we can move them into a child and youth care center. It is true that in stations where you would have a rural area where maybe the child and youth care center is 400 kilometers away, we really have to detain a child, but only when we really have to detain, where the child is a danger to themselves or to others. We would detain them in a cell separately from adults, and we would monitor them. So in certain stations have enough cells that they can say this is our distinct cell for detention of children. We try not to refer to juveniles anymore. So they would set aside a specific cell, and they can even make specific provisions in the cell to make it more child-friendly. But if they don't have the means to set aside a specific cell, then it's just put the child in a cell where they separate from adults, not with anybody that can be a danger to them, where they can end in monitoring. So they could be a cell. They could even use, sometimes we have a cell that we use while we're booking people set closer to the sea. They might even keep the children in that cell so that the people on duty can keep an eye on them, because again they might be in danger. So we basically often we have cells set aside for women, for children at sea in the Western Cape specifically. They even have cells set aside for LGBTI individuals at the moment. But some stations would only have two cells, and so they would basically put the child in a separate cell. They could even keep the child in an office with a member So basically, under the personal care of a member until such time as they can release a child to a care of someone else, usually an adult or someone who takes responsibility for them, could be a child abuse center as well. Unfortunately, with the national instructions, it's detailed because we're trying to make provisions for every possible eventuality. But you do always find that one example where you go to the station and say, you know, we have this situation and you didn't make provisions for that. And that is where police often, and often there are the police at the police stations that must come up with the means and make a plan. And that is where they sometimes work with the, they might, for instance, identify an office and so on in the police station. It is, and I want to recognize though that the Honourable Member is correct, it is often more difficult for the stations in the rural areas that are far from all the other service providers. We do, however, have good relationships between the different departments, and from the probation officer's environment, we engage with them and we try to work out how will we deal with, for instance, in this police station, if we need assistance, what is our arrangements that we could engage with social development, so that police don't have to look for or wonder how to do with something. They should get every police station an arrangement that says, if this happened, this is the person I call and this is what I can expect of them. So it's almost like in a local arrangement to work with the probation officer so that we don't have to, in every instance, look for an answer. Issue of police members clusters on LGBTI cases. I just want to get a specific question in terms of the service providers, the NGO and CBOs that do training. Our training statistics that we provide, and we can provide the statistics for the human rights in policing training, which we usually deal with LGBTI issues, specifically in our training for human rights in policing, where we want to inculcate respect for human rights of every individual. We deal with specifically in the victim empowerment training program. We deal with specifically in training programs for sexual offenders as well. But we don't have an LGBTI course and capture the statistics basically in terms of courses that police have registered and accredited. So it may be that there are NGOs that have done training for the officials, including police, but our training at administration system wouldn't capture those statistics because we haven't accredited those training courses. But that is something that, as the general indicators, we will follow up with our HRD division. We will then provide the breakdown, the detailed breakdown of the charges. And in terms of the additional questions that the Honourable Scullabard had requested in terms of are fewer children in contact with the law and can't be sentenced, more of fear in prison, I don't want to try and answer that off the cuff because that requires information from either department, so we'll do that in writing. Okay. Why does it take so much time to find out the guidelines and what do guidelines mean? We distinguish between guidelines and national instructions essentially because a guideline is meant to be a resource. It's meant to assist the members with how can you deal with something. Sometimes with legislation and national instructions, there's something you must do. But in certain instances, for instance, dealing with people with disabilities, there are international conventions and there are policy documents, but there's not necessarily an act that speaks to every eventuality when the police deals with a person with a disability. So we provide guidelines to give members it's literally to be a resource to the members, to give them options of what they can do, suggestions, to assist them. And it's not an instruction because it requires members to exercise discretion and to consider the best option in a certain context. And that's why we usually call it a guideline rather than an instruction, because the moment you make that instruction, if you don't follow that instruction exactly, you can then charge a member. And in certain instances, you want the members to be able to exercise some discretion, but to give them a good practice guide. So usually good practices, guidelines are based on good practices and suggestions for how members can deal with issues. There are national instructions in place that deal with the requirements. The guidelines is meant as an additional resource to police members. So it's a request that comes from the forums that we work with external stakeholders that we come up with these guidelines. So it's not that it's taken us long yet, but it's a new initiative that came out of engagement with the Disability Forum. And some of that speaks to, for instance, how can we use and work with the other the organization in that field. For instance, with Deaf EA, I can work with them in terms of sign language interpreters. Again, so it will provide an additional resource to the members. I think that's I don't have another option anymore, General. Perhaps that's it.
Okay. Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. I want to just add on the issue of secondary victimization. Just to say, as part of, except for the training, but also during station lectures, members are sensitized. We could make them aware on how they must reach their victims. And also, during the duty on GO parades, members are also briefed. And then as part of the funds and service delivery pilot project that we are currently rolling out,
in police stations, but also training management on change management, and also to ensure that in some of the stations, especially new built police stations, we are ensuring that we are putting cameras in the land service centers so that if there can be any complaints about such nature, then we can be able to follow up and use the video, you know, material to charge the members. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair.
I call
with Josie
Tole.
Yes, thanks very much. Just the few, there's also areas that are dealing with the international crime prevention strategy, which is your single mothers below the age of 20. We link them to this act. We also link the homeless profile to it, your collapsed family structures. We also confronting the number of children expelled from school. We're confronting that with education, and we also deal with the victim profile. Just in closing from our right, I wanted to start by maybe thanking you for the leadership that you provide in the committee. But I wanted to thank honorable members for the questions that they asking us, because one should stand up and say thank you for making us aware, because we do not come here to defend, and we will never. We come here to present our performance, and we come here to present what government has assigned to us as a mandate. We therefore want to be questioned, to be criticized, so that we can improve. And on all the areas which has been identified by the committee, we're definitely going to work on them. By next time when we come here, we will be better and we will not be the same. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, General Sitole, honorable members. Maybe there's just a few documents. I'll give the list to Colonel Stein. It's 5 documents that we just need additionally. The guidelines for the protection of older persons, the National Instruction 2 of 2014, the elderly persons, the National Intervention Strategy on LGBTI, and then the frequent asked questions regarding LGBTI, and as well as the stats on the children per age that was indicated. Thank you very much. I think it was a very good presentation from the side of CHAPS. We welcome that. Maybe just the members, I've asked the research question. Researchers quickly look in the question that was raised here, eliminate. It's quite clear that Honorable Ramakrishna is correct, but what we will do, we'll ask the researchers to submit an official research note on the issue of the FCS units. So we will then table it at the next meeting. In terms of our first meeting this morning, we will next week, apart from the Secretary of Police that will come here on EVA, we will also call the head of IPAC regarding the vetting and the status, because there are clearly challenges and also discrepancies that we will have to address. So thank you very much, members, for your participation and cooperation. Thank you. The meeting is adjourned.